STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
All right, friends, here we are, Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason, and glad to be chatting with you today. Looking forward, in fact, to talking directly with a number of you. As our show moves on, 3 hours of careful thinking about the things that are most important to think about, ethics, values, and religion. Before we get launched, though, I want to talk with one of my buddies, my colleague here at Stand to Reason, Brett Kunkel. Brett, good to talk to you, buddy.
Hey, missed your staff meeting today, so it's good to talk to you, Greg.
You know what? I heard your boy took a bump.
Yeah, he broke a leg, literally.
Gosh. And you mean literally, don't you?
Yeah, so Sunday he did that, and so we are just trying to nurse him back to health and getting a cast on him tomorrow.
What actually happened, just very briefly? Because we were praying about it today, but I didn't have the details.
Yeah, he was just on a trampoline with some other kids and kind of bounced up and down, and we didn't see exactly what happened, and he just started screaming. And he broke the bone, one of the bones that runs from the knee to the calf, right under the knee. He cracked it.
Empathy pains right now. Ouch.
Yeah.
Well, you're at home nursing him back to health a little bit today, but we're also going to chat a little bit about a big event coming up here in, what, about 4 weeks or 3 weeks now?
Yeah, 3 weeks.
Rethink. October 25th and 26th at Crossline Church in Laguna Hills. We did this last year, and it was a fabulous success. I think there were 400 young people there and some older folk, too. But this is focusing on young people, and the numbers look right now, I think that we have over 300 signed up. And compared to last time around, that's twice as many as were signed up this time last time. And last time you ended up with 400. So who knows how many you're going to have this time around, maybe 500 or more. It's really looking good.
Yeah, we're looking forward to a large crowd there. It's actually almost three times as many signed up at this time last year than
we have this year.
So, yeah, hopefully we'll have a big crowd there and be able to impact a lot of young people.
Well, Brett, remind our listeners here what the Rethink Conference is and why they need to come.
Well, we know that our young people are not prepared for this culture, generally speaking. They're not prepared, and if we're not intentional, they certainly won't be prepared. We see this all the time when we work with young people. I was up at Hume Lake this past week getting to speak to hundreds and hundreds of students all throughout the summer, and the leadership there, just as an example, asked us to speak on the topic of homosexuality because this is the hot topic in youth ministry. And week after week, you could just see these students had never been equipped with more than a couple of Bible verses, had never been taught really the facts of reality on this topic, had never learned any kind of moral reasoning on this, and were just hungering for the kind of training that we were able to offer. In fact, the youth leaders were hungering for this training because many of them even confessed to us that they did not feel equipped to address such a topic.
It's just amazing to me, and I know we've had somebody there at Hume Lake every single week this summer, and I'm so proud of our team weighing in with the young people. My understanding was that the young people flocked to the events that had to do with apologetics. These were voluntary things that they could come to, and you guys just, you know, had huge groups compared to the other groups virtually every single week.
There were optional seminars. The apologetic seminars were optional, and almost every single session, the rooms are packed out, students are sitting on the floor. The afternoon session was actually during free time, and that's when we did the topic of homosexuality, and we'd still get a couple hundred kids who could have been out paintballing or out on the lake or hanging with their friends. They came out for the topic because they were desperate to get equipped on this stuff.
Brett, why do you think this homosexuality issue is so from their perspective, why are they showing up to talk about this? Because this is one of the controversial issues. It's the ones that Christians get called out on and called names about probably more than anything else. Why do you think most of those students were showing up during paintball time and hiking and, goodness me, fishing time there at Human Lake in order to hear a talk on homosexuality from you guys?
Well, I think a lot of them are dealing with this at their schools and with their friends. So they've got friends who are starting to come out, who are feeling more of a freedom and more of an acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And so more of their friends are coming out, or they're hearing about people at their schools who are coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to figure out, how do I navigate this? In fact, you had here in Southern California at Huntington Beach High School, you had a transgender student who was just elected as the homecoming queen at her school. So this is front and center on their school campuses. It's in the culture. Their friends are coming out as gay, and so they're asking, okay, what do I even think about this? How do I deal with this? I know what people say that this is wrong, but how do I square this with friends who are coming out? So so here you have this issue that's in their face, in the culture, and so many churches and parents and youth leaders and Christian educators are ill-equipped. They are having equipped themselves to be able to equip their youth and prepare their youth for these kind of challenges.
Well, you know, just about exactly a year ago, I think this week, or maybe last week, I was at Harvest Fellowship, Greg Laurie's church in Riverside, addressing this very issue. And they filled that gallery up, and there must have been 1,200 young people in that gallery. And part of the point that I was making, and I'm curious about your response to this, I taught on Bible and homosexuality and same-sex marriage, and it was for the purpose of equipping them. And the reason that I'm so concerned about this is not because homosexuality is way up there on the theological pecking order. I mean, it's not. It's not mentioned hardly at all in the Bible. It's not a feature of any church councils or anything like that. It's not in the confessions, etc. But it just strikes me that even so, it's strategically important right now because this is the place where the culture is drawing the line for our young people and others and saying you have to cross this line and compromise your view. You have to celebrate diversity so that we will love and accept you. And the threat of being called narrow-minded or bigoted. That's the new – it used to be intolerant. Now it's bigot is the challenge or the ad hominem of choice. Just the threat of that is causing, it seems, a lot of young people to step across and saying, I'm going to side with the world here instead of siding with Christ. And that strikes me as the reason, at least from my perspective, and I wanted to get your feedback on this, Brett, why it's so strategically important to be able to answer those issues right now.
Yeah, I think you're right. In fact, I think with the young people, the term isn't bigoted. What they're being called are haters.
Yeah.
This has shifted from you being intolerant to now, okay, you actually hate gay people.
Mm-hmm.
You hate these folks. And so that challenge comes, you know, in students' face. And yeah, they have no reason to, you know, to stand their ground on this, so they give. But they have in the background, well, doesn't the Bible somehow forbid this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they compromise on that one, and then it's so much easier to compromise on other issues. And then what happens is just the Bible kind of slowly fades to the background of life, if it's not already just in the background of life,
right,
and loses any kind of relevance. In fact, Dave Kinnaman, he's with the Barna Group, he wrote a book called You Lost Me, where he's looking at kind of this whole idea of a, you know, youth exodus and what are some of the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things he says in his book, which I thought was very telling, he says, as he surveyed students, youth group teenagers who aspire to some kind of science-related career, it was like 52% of teenagers in our typical youth group. And then they asked, well, youth pastors and youth workers, well, how many of you had addressed issues of science in the past year? It was 1%. 1% of our youth groups that addressed something that half of our young people are going into, are going to go study as a career. And this is just kind of across the board when it comes to these issues. We are just not relevant in just dealing with these
things.
They're
not.
And so I think for a lot of young people, okay, that's kind of irrelevant, and it just continues to undermine the authority of Scripture in the lives of young people.
Well, it also underscores the lack of training in real world stuff that our young people are going to face when they get out of the protection of their youth groups and their families, and they are on their own. They're not there with their buddies and everybody else. So you're sent off to a new location where nobody's looking over their shoulder, nobody's making sure they're reading their Bible, nobody's checking at what time they come in. They're totally on their own. And then they are getting harassed and challenged by all of these, in a certain sense, kind of academic things that in addition to the moral challenges they're facing, that now the academic things are saying, well, look at the stuff that you believe that's kind of getting in the way of your nightlife here, these things are just ridiculous. They're false. And these kids just have no answers to these challenges, even though the answers are there.
Yeah. And when they don't have the intellectual resources, then the moral challenges that they face come along and just wipe them out.
Mm-hmm. I'm reading right now to my daughter the C.S. Lewis's, I think it's his first book after his conversion, which called Pilgrim's Regress, and in that book, it's kind of an allegorical story about how he became a Christian, kind of. And one of the things in the story is the young lad who was under the burden of believing in God and the law, and he couldn't keep it. When he realized that there was no, as the story goes, no landlord to answer for, which is the analog to God, he experienced a tremendous sense of freedom and this idea that he could do whatever he wanted. He was out from under. He was on his own. He was his own person. And I remember feeling the exact same thing when I went away to college and left all my religious underpinnings behind. And I think this is the same thing that happens to folks, young people, when they not only get on their own, but then they have these academic challenges that they can't answer placed upon them. And they think, oh, all right, well, I guess I was wrong. Hey, party hardy.
Yeah, and that's exactly why parents have got to prepare them before they leave home.
Well, that's a great segue into some of the details on the Rethink Conference, because this is precisely what you have in mind with these conferences. And this is something we're going to be doing, I suspect, no commitments here, but we did this last year, and we're doing it again this year, and it's looking like it's really working out to be a raging success because people see the need for this. So there's a good chance we're going to be doing Rethinks in the future, and giving an opportunity to people in other parts of the country to have access to what you're going to be providing here in a few weeks. Give us a little rundown on what the Saturday, or make that Friday evening and Saturday, is going to look like.
Well, let me step back and kind of give everyone a kind of a picture of what we want to accomplish here. You know, we're trying to help parents and youth leaders and Christian educators who feel ill-equipped. We're trying to come alongside them and say, hey, we've got some resources to help you. You don't have to be the expert on all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. You've got some friends and some partners and allies who are going to help you. So we want to come alongside, provide this two-day conference where students can come. And there's really kind of three real distinctives that of this conference. It's geared for young people. Mm-hmm. And so, number one, we're placing high expectations on them. We have two talks on Friday night. We've got four more main sessions on Saturday. We've got two sessions of breakout sessions, so mm-hmm. there's additional talks. So there is a lot of content packed in here, mm-hmm. and it's good content. It's solid content. It's going to raise the bar. It's not going to be the typical love Jesus and be good mm-hmm. kind of content that you see in so much youth curriculum out there. We're raising the expectations.
Which, by the way, just so people don't misunderstand, there's nothing wrong with loving Jesus and being good, but it's not enough. It's not enough
anymore.
Yeah,
let me clarify. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's about the depth of the teaching, is that it's love Jesus, be good, and there's no more content to it than that. It's just a very kind of shallow, moralistic, God's kind of in the background and mm-hmm. just kind of be moral kind mm-hmm. of message. Mm-hmm. So we want to put a lot of meat on that. And help people with their young people.
First,
high expectations.
That's the first thing. Content, high expectations, come to be challenged. You're going to get a lot of stuff. Bring your notebook, bring your pen, and get rested up and be ready to get some meat.
That's right. And then number two, at the same time, it's going to be accessible. And this is where I've worked hard to bring in communicators who can communicate to young people, who can take high-level stuff like this and solid content and yet communicate it in a way that really connects with young people. Mm-hmm. They see its relevance. You know, we've got the two great communicators who are joining the STR team for the conference, John Stone Street of Summit Ministries, right. Scott Klusendorf, our old friend from LTI.
Yes.
Of course, then the STR speakers, Jim, you, Alan, me, will all be there to communicate. So we're making it accessible. So right. even though we've got high expectations, we're going to work hard to make this stuff accessible. So that young people walk away feeling, okay, that made sense. I see the relevance. I feel equipped. And then the third kind of part of this is them being very interactive. We have built-in Q&A times for every single session. So we want to give students a significant time after the talk to ask some questions, to clarify, to get some stuff out on the table. We also ask our speakers to be available, you know, so we'll be there, many of us will be there throughout the entire conference, mixing it up with the crowds, interacting with students in between sessions, sitting amongst the students rather than hiding out, you know, in a in a green room. We want to be very interactive with young
people. And that's really Standard Reason style anyway. You know, I when I head out and do my things, and I know you run into this too, people are sometimes surprised that we're the first ones there and the last ones to leave. You know, because we got a blue-collar work mentality. We're there to serve, and we want to make sure that that people's needs are properly met in the little time that we have to work with that particular group, a day or two. And then we're going off somewhere else, so we want to make sure that they get what they need, and we're not going to hide on them. And we're regular folk. We're out there serving the Lord. We just want to be close to people who want to learn from us.
And that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
A good thing. So, well, that's great. I just surveyed the breakdown here, the topics that are being covered, the people. I'm looking forward to seeing all you guys. You know, we're scattered all over the country. Although you and I and Jay Warner were all in North Carolina last weekend, but we are just at different spots, you know.
Yeah.
So our paths didn't cross, but it's fun to be able to be together working the same event and have John Stone Street from Summit there, a friend of ours for a long, long time, a fabulous communicator. Of course, Scott Klusendorf, now with Life Training Institute, probably the best communicator on the pro-life issue in the whole country. And to have everybody there at once, it's just going to be a lot of fun. So I'm looking forward to that. Give us the details once again if people want to find out how they can sign up and be a part and connect and, you know, when, where, how, why, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, it's in October. It's Friday and Saturday.
By the way, October is this month. This is the first.
Right.
So it's
right.
Surprise,
October 25th
surprise.
And 26th. So it's just in a few weekends here.
Mm-hmm.
The online registration is still open. You can register. It's only $35. For the entire conference, which is an incredible deal.
That's really great.
You can register at rethinkapologetics.com.
Okay.
And that's where you can find out all the details. You can look at the schedule. You can see who's speaking. You can see the topics. We're covering everything from the problem of evil to worldview to tolerance to tactics to abortion to Islam. So we're going to be covering a lot of ground.
That's great. They can also get a link there from str.org, as I recall, right? Isn't that kind of front and center on the homepage?
That's right. Yeah, you can go to str.org as well, and it'll be one of the top banners there.
Okay. Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing you. Sorry I missed you today at staff meeting, Brett. I know you're working really hard, and take care of the boy. And I guess you got a bunch of sick kids, too, in addition to one with a broken leg.
Well, not sick kids, a sick wife.
Oh, a sick mom. That's
sick
okay.
Kids.
The kids were sick last week. She took care of them. Then mom got sick from the sick kids. They're feeling better. And now you got a boy with a broken leg and a sick mom. And God bless you, Brett. Isn't it great being a dad?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Well, I see. I look forward to seeing you, though, in a few weeks. And I'll give this information one more time for the listeners. But thanks a lot, Brett. I'll let you get back to your family and your boy.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
All right, buddy. Brett Kunkel, really the motivation behind the Rethink Apologetics Conference. Want the details on that? Go to rethinkapologetics.com or simply str.org and punch through on the homepage there. You'll see a banner and some information that'll let you get to the website proper. You can still sign up for it. It's going to be at Crossline Church in Laguna Hills, same place we had it last time. And incidentally, last year we had I'm thinking my old home church, Hope Chapel, had a big contingent that came out last year. They just kind of made a short road trip of it, and they're going to do the same thing this year. So you may want to think about bringing all your people. Instead of coming out just one by one, why don't you grab your group and make this an event for your group and make this, say, a launching pad maybe for a new way of approaching your own confidence in Christ and the way you navigate in the world with regards to Christianity. This is a great start for that. So bring your whole group. That can be done too. Just go to rethinkapologetics.com or str.org and click on the Rethink Apologetics picture there, and hope to see you October 25th, 26th at Crossline Church in Laguna Hills. All right, let's take a break. We got lots of callers on board, and I'm going to jump right in as soon as we return. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
I have a suggestion for you. Subscribe to STR's monthly publications, Solid Ground and Greg's Mentoring Letter. Just go to str.org and click on the subscription button at the top of the page. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. We'll send you the bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, that Greg Kokel writes on an in-depth subject, free for a year. We'll also send you his bi-monthly mentoring letter that he writes on practical skills you need to be an ambassador for Christ. These are no ordinary newsletters. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ for free. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like why the Bible is reliable, evolution, abortion, timely issues so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador for Christ on key issues you will be challenged on. You can go to str.org, subscribe to the e-news to receive Solid Ground and the mentoring letter.
Don't forget, Stand to Reason's live broadcast is Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. on the web. That's Pacific time, by the way. So go to str.org to listen live or use your STR app to stream it live. You can also give me a piece of your mind by calling at that time, Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number, 855-243-9975. And, of course, you can listen on the radio, like always, on Sundays, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. But for the live broadcast, tune in online Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time by going to str.org. Greg Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind as I do every Tuesday night from 4 until 7. And I'm just emphasizing that many of you are used to our new times now because we're not live on the weekends anymore on Sunday afternoon in Southern California. We are live on Tuesday evenings in Southern California. This gives us, you know, the best reach of time around the country, it seems, in terms of people being able to listen, and it frees up my weekends. And it seems like since we started, I haven't been home hardly a weekend because, and the idea was maybe I go to church more often, but that's only happened a couple of times. Anyway, this is a good schedule but it means that you also have to call in on Tuesdays rather than Sunday. And if you're listening to the show in any of our markets, you may not be getting the entire show either. American Family Radio Network, you know, sometimes 1 hour, sometimes 2 hours, I guess. And also in Southern California, our KBRT network, we're cut back to only 2 hours there. Coming up here in a couple of weeks, and we won't have the full 3 hours there. Here's what I want to say. Wherever you are, from wherever you listen, if you like this show, podcast it. It's real simple. Go to iTunes, go to str.org, sign up, no sweat. You get delivered. The show gets delivered to you every single, Wednesday. I guess it pretty much goes up on Wednesday, just the day after the show. And then you have it forever. And you could pass it on to somebody else. You can listen to it at your leisure. Because if it turns out that your local market, your local radio market dries up for some reason, and this happens, we are still going to be here. I'll still be here on Tuesday evenings from 4 until 7, barking it out and taking your calls and answering your questions and helping you be better ambassadors for Christ. So if we don't reach you anymore with a radio broadcast in your area, then you can get us on podcasts. So I encourage you to start right away, because if we start losing hours in some market, you can catch all 3 hours on the podcast. This also means that if you want to weigh in, like this full bank of callers that we have right now want to weigh in with something, you've got to call when I'm on the air, and that's Tuesdays from 4 until 7 in Los Angeles. I always have to do this slowly now to get it right. Maybe I should write it down somewhere so I don't mess it up. All right, let's go to our first caller, Garrett in Georgia. Garrett, hey.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, sir.
Greg, first of all, I just want to say I really enjoy your show. I listen primarily through the podcast. I just found out about it. I was assigned reading for your book, Tactics, for my first semester of master's courses towards apologetics degree.
Where was that at? Are you studying at Biola?
No, sir. It's at Luther Rice Seminary. It's right outside of Atlanta.
Well, that's great. I'm so glad. I never heard of Luther Rice, but I have a very high opinion of them if they're requiring you to read my book. So,
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I've even used it on my in my job as I work with other people, just in conversation.
That's
and it
great.
It's amazing what it can do.
It makes things easier, doesn't it?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
But my call is about today. It's ironic because I had planned on calling the show today, and because my brother-in-law, he is homosexual, and I believe it was ordained, obviously, because that's what you guys were talking about in the first little bit. I didn't know that you were going to be discussing that, but
It just kind of came up, serendipitously. We didn't plan it; it just kind of came up. Yeah.
Yes, sir. But I've only been married for about 4 years, and so I've only known him for that length of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he lives further away. He lives in New York. I live in Georgia. And mm-hmm. so I don't get to see him as often. And so whenever we have seen him at holidays or whatnot, we've tried to have conversation. And of course, my wife has talked with him throughout the years about his lifestyle, and
mm-hmm.
for a time he was actually open about conversation, and then after a while he began to be very closed off, especially
mm-hmm.
whenever he moved to New York, where it's a larger city and more
mm-hmm.
homosexuals
mm-hmm.
and more support, I guess, for that lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never, we've been there to visit him, we've stayed with him, we've tried to show him, you know, love and care, but it seems like recently we encounter a lot of ad hominem attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we talk with him or discuss something with him, he gets very upset about minor things that if we don't approve of his lifestyle, if we don't ask him about his partner, and it's very difficult about, you know, to know
mm-hmm.
where the line is
yeah.
of where I'm showing care and then where's compromise at,
yeah,
you know?
right I can appreciate that, especially when you're under fire so readily from your brother-in-law, because it is very, very difficult to be able to find any place of, in a certain sense, neutrality. Like, is this, where's the safe ground that I can stand on in my
right.
relationship with you that allows us, or more accurately, let me put it this way, and you could tell me if I'm mistaken, that allows a circumstance where I, that would be you, are treated in a civil fashion. Because what I almost said was where we can be respectful of each other, but my suspicion is, and this is what you have to answer, my suspicion is you probably been working real hard to be respectful of him as an individual and as a human being in the process of these discussions.
Yes,
but,
sir.
But simply being courteous and respectful is not enough to him. What he is going to demand is that you be approving in some sense celebrate the relationship, or he is not going to be civil towards you. Is that a fair and accurate
statement? Yes, sir. That's pretty much the way it seems that it has been. because even whenever we visited him, I had the opportunity to kind of have a long conversation with just us two and mm-hmm. just asking him about and just letting him tell me about his life mm-hmm. because I haven't known him all that long uh-huh. and just trying to understand and just letting him know and showing him that we care. But mm-hmm. it does seem like what you're saying is like whenever we encounter him, if we don't, you know, fully embrace everything that he is about, even though we don't preach at him, we just talk to him about normal things and mm-hmm. we just try to insert the gospel here and there, but I never make it, since I've known him, it has caused me to see that, you know, mm-hmm. Homosexuality is just another sin, just mm-hmm. like anything else. Mm-hmm. And so I can't elevate his sin above mine because I would be a hypocrite.
Yeah, well, I think some sins are worse than others, but I think your general approach is a good one, that you're
right.
not trying to make yourself to be the good guy
right.
and to be the bad yep. guy in virtue of his homosexuality, but rather, he needs the Lord regardless of what his own
right.
sins happen to be. Let me ask you a couple of quick questions before I give
sure.
you a response here. And does your brother-in-law claim to be a Christian?
Well, earlier on in life, my wife said that he had gone to church a couple times and claimed to have said a prayer of some
mm-hmm.
sort, but
yeah.
there really hasn't been any fruit
yeah,
there.
Right. That's the problem of kind of banking on prayers of friends'
yes,
prayers
sir.
About Christ, because that's not the acid test, really, ultimately. But the thing is, he would not consider himself – he probably wouldn't say, I'm a Christian, but you are being unchristian towards me. That's not his complaint.
No, sir.
Okay.
It would be more of just an attitude
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, okay, got it. Second question is, with regards to the conversations that you have had, do you feel like you are able to have normal interactions with him, or do you feel like the times you're together, do you always bring up the homosexuality issue and it puts him on the defensive, or are you just trying to be regular but not necessarily championing his cause, and then he finds fault with you?
It'd probably be more of like what you're talking about in the second response, because I have never, since I've known him, brought up the fact that he is a homosexual.
Oh, I see.
I stay away from that subject.
Huh, okay.
I just try to embrace him with love and show him love through.
Okay, good. Because I wasn't sure if maybe there was trouble because every time you get together, you guys are stirring it up with him on this issue. And
oh,
I can
no,
understand
sir.
Your motivation, but that's not a good policy. So it's good that you're not
okay.
doing that. And just for people listening, you know, sometimes it's, yeah, they're always so mad at me. Well, you're always stepping on their toes kind of thing.
Okay.
And it doesn't mean that the issue never needs to be addressed or talked about, but I think we have to exercise care. And partly
right.
my attitude is if people don't want to talk about something spiritual, I don't usually try to force
right.
the issue, you know. So, but you're not forcing the issue. This is something else. So, okay, I had two thoughts about responses
okay.
that you might use when you're talking with him
okay.
about these issues, and that, and these are both going to be questions.
Okay.
So this is Columbo tactic style, but it's the third use of Columbo because you're really going to be making a point with your questions here, and
okay.
Let's just say he starts berating you and attacking you with regards to your Christianity and starts using ad hominems.
Okay.
It seems to me it's entirely justified at that point for you to say, do you mind if I ask you a question? You know, what is it? Well, why is it that every time this issue comes up that you resort to hate speech towards us?
Right.
So what we're doing is we're trying to leverage the language a little bit in our favor here, because you're not the one who is saying nasty things to him, as far as I can tell, and
yes,
yet
sir.
He is probably accusing you of being hateful and spiteful. I mean, this happens all the time. It
yes,
just
sir.
All the time. And so I think it's fair then to simply ask the question with regards to him. Why do you resort to hate speech towards us? Why do you do that? And so now it's up to him to respond. And yes, and if he says, well, that's because you're being hateful to me, he says, then tell me exactly what am I doing that is that is hateful. Can you define hate for me? You know, that you might use that term, think that term is appropriate to me. No, see, I think they're going to get in a box at that point, presuming there's nothing that you're doing that is inappropriately antagonistic.
Right.
Yeah, so that's what's key. We got to mind our manners here for Christ's sake and also for the, in a sense, the argument's sake.
Yes, sir.
Both things are in view. But from what you've told me, I think you have been minding your manners, so it's appropriate to ask that question. Why is it that you resort to hate speech? You could use that phrase if you feel comfortable. Or maybe, why do you resort to ridicule? Ridicule's not an argument. This is a phrase that is helpful to remember because you could offer it and just say, well, ridicule is not an argument. Why are you ridiculing me?
Yes, sir.
So that's one question, some form of that. And then the second question is much like it. And that is, why are you being so intolerant to me? I want to have I don't mind having a discussion about this, but when we start discussing, you are very, very intolerant of my own views. So again, we're using their language, language which they use inappropriately of us, which actually applies to them. Then and then we're using it to them. So it's kind of a turnabout. And I'd be interested. I don't know what he's going to say, but at least that gives you a foothold. You can't say it, you know, in a snide way or a snarky way or in a nasty way. You have to just ask it genuinely. You know, why are you being so intolerant to me?
Yes, sir. And I've tried to in my conversations with him, you know, I've tried to be always respectful. I'm not by nature. I'm a more calmer person, and so it takes a lot to make me or cause me to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to be just dialogue and just asking questions. And even before I read your book, I naturally ask a lot of questions. And so, but it just seems like there is whenever there's like the least inkling of us not putting forth a parade of sorts, then, I mean, we don't have to say anything. We don't have to, I mean, like I said, we don't even talk about his lifestyle. We just talk about normal everyday things.
Yeah.
And
he
it
finds
always
an opportunity.
Comes up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Well, and everybody that's listening, we're just going to have to get used to this. Many people know the drill because it's happened to them many, many, many times. The people that are clamoring about hate speech are the ones that are actually manifesting the most animosity in the conversation. And maybe hate is too strong a word in some cases, but in many cases it is not. This is actually manifestations of hateful attitudes that homosexuals have towards Christians, and you can see it in their faces. And I do not think that that's a fair characterization of most Christians who engage in conversation about this. But anyway,
and I feel like you know that that a lot of the Christianity in the past, like of my, I'm 32 years old, and so a lot of like my parents' age, homosexuality was not what it is today, and so there was maybe that bad taste in a lot of people's mouth that, you know, that homosexuality was kind of the only sin that was trumped up, you know, and that was cast out. And so I think we fight almost a battle against that where we constantly have to say, yes, it is a sin, but, you know, not the only sin, and I'm not going to put you out because of it. I still love you in the Lord and pray for your salvation.
Yes,
but,
and if you're in like you just described, as you have been describing, if you're actually showing behavior consistent with your claim to love him, then that's going to have much more credibility. Or let's just put it this way, it will be a credible statement even if he doesn't give more credibility to it. And we can never count on on the other side playing fair in this regard. So I thank you for your call, Garrett, and appreciate what you're going through. And I hope this has been an encouragement to other people as well. My parting words here are just this, that we all be very careful not to fulfill the stereotype. Now, I think the stereotype is a dishonest stereotype. That is, people have characterized us in ways that we are not. Hateful, spiteful, arrogant, narrow-minded, intolerant, bigoted. These are the kinds of words that are used to describe us. I do not think on balance that any of these characterizations are accurate. Can you find some people like that? Of course you can. On balance, though, they are not accurate, though on balance, the outsiders believe this is the way Christians are, largely because this is what they've been telling each other for a long time, which means we have to be very careful not to do anything that can look like we're fulfilling the stereotype. All right? All right, let's take a break. Back with more calls here on Stand to Reason.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kokel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study the Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting STR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order the Bible Fast Forward.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
The show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel, your host, back with you here. And, okay, let's go to our next caller in. At first, I thought it was Bigfoot, Montana, but it's Big Fort. Is that right?
Big Fork.
Okay. Joe.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you, Mr. Coco. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thanks.
Yeah. Good. I've been enjoying your podcast a lot lately. I have a job where I can listen to two a day. So.
Oh, my goodness.
6 hours of you every day.
You know, somebody told me that my speed on the air was just right so that they can double me up and listen coherently to a whole show in an hour and a half.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know if you thought about that, but you maybe.
Well, I'm already feeling like I'm going to run out because I just listened to the Christmas episode of last year and it started getting me in the Christmas mood.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's a little early for me. I don't allow myself to even look at any Christmas decorations, even if they're up in stores, until after Thanksgiving. That's kind of my rule. But anyway, Joe, what do you got?
Yeah. Well, I had a question about government and marriage. Mm-hmm. I know you've talked a lot about that, and mm-hmm. I was just sort of thinking over some of it, and you had talked about how the government has an investment in the future generation. Is that mm-hmm. sort of
Broadly, yeah. What I'd say is that there is something unique about long-term heterosexual unions, and that is, and now I'm choosing my words carefully. In fact, I have this, I've memorized it, but I have it on the card of the same-sex marriage quick reference guide that you can get. But what's unique about it is that as a group, as a rule, and by nature, they provide the next generation. They produce the next generation. And the government has a compelling policy interest in those who produce the next generation. But notice the words that I chose: as a group, as a rule, and by nature. Okay. Mm-hmm. And when one makes policy decisions, now policy decisions, I'm referring specifically to the government passing laws regarding something. That's what we mean when we say policy. When they make decisions, there's a rule, a general rule that's a wise rule, although sometimes it's ignored in the rhetoric of politics. And the rule is hard cases make bad policy. Hard cases make bad policy. And the reason that's a good dictum is because if you focus on the hard or the unusual cases, the cases that are not characteristic, you end up making the masses, or like taking the masses captive to legislation that applies to very few people. And this is why the portion of my answer to you, as a group, as a rule, and by nature, is so important to the concept of policy with regards to marriage. The government is supposed to make policies that pertain to the masses as such, not for the hard cases, for the strays. Now, that rule has been ignored a lot recently, but I still think it's a good rule.
What would you say if someone argued, if they said the government should provide incentives to only people who have children?
Okay. That's not an argument, first of all. That's a point of view. So you said, what if somebody argued this? And I'm going to pick at this for a minute because it's important. If they argued it, I'd listen to the argument. But just saying it isn't an argument. They'd have to say, then why? What is it that – here's how I would ask it, Joe. I'd say, what is it that they're giving incentives for? You said the government should provide incentives. What is it they're giving incentives for, and why should the government give incentives in this circumstance? That's the question. So the argument proper is what?
The government has interest in the next generation, so
yes,
they should provide incentives to people who are raising children.
What is the incentive? When you provide an incentive, you're giving somebody something in order to get them to do something else. Is that what you mean by incentive, or do you just mean help?
Or, yeah, help.
Entitlement. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
they do. If you are not married and you have a child, you have a dependent. You can declare that child as a dependent. You get a tax credit, and you get a dependent status. So people already do that, whether they're married or not. Doesn't matter if they're married to a man or a woman or not married at all. If they have a dependent child, they get a tax benefit. So what would be accomplished by new legislation that's not already taking place?
I guess I'm just trying to think of – yeah, because I agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I figured you did. I'm just kind of – role-playing it a little bit with you.
Because
I know people bring these things up and they're trying to find, you know, strained reasons for wanting to get the government or the people to change their definition about something, which presumes, by the way, that the definition of marriage can be changed to include same-sex relationships. But I don't think marriage is defined. I think it's described. It's a feature of reality that is not invented by a definition by cultures, but rather is something discovered as part of the human condition or the reality of being human, that it takes a mom and a dad to make children. And this is true even with same-sex unions. That is, they don't have children. unless they do something extreme by way of technology. But this is part of the reason that I pointed out that the long-term heterosexual unions as a group, as a rule, and by nature, this is normal and ordinary for those unions, so that children are by nature the products of a mother and father and by nature have a mother and father. And so if we then engineer something culturally that deprives children of a mother or a father by design, why would that be a good thing? Now, I know it satisfies the desires of those same-sex couples that want to have children. That's not what I'm asking, because this should not be about giving people what they desire, but giving children what they deserve, a mom and a dad. So I'm against same-sex couples adopting unless that's the only option for a child who is otherwise without any care.
Yeah.
Which is almost never, in this country, virtually never the case, because the line goes around the block about 100 times of people waiting to get any child, couples waiting to get any child, since the vast majority, since so many children who are not wanted are just simply aborted.
Yeah.
There aren't children to go around. And so whatever children do go around, then they shouldn't be given to a same-sex couple, because a same-sex couple, by natural design, is not adequate for a child who needs a mom and a dad. Of course, I'm speaking generalizations here. Are there some same-sex couples that would be better than some heterosexual couples at parenting? Yes, of course. But hard cases make bad policy, once again.
Do you know if there's any studies on other countries who have had same-sex marriage for longer times that have – it would be nice. I haven't looked into it much, so I'm sure there is.
Well, there is a study right now that comes out of – and maybe the enforcer has this. I've got it on my computer, and I can maybe send it to her during break. But there is a study just recently come out. I say within the last year and a half or 2 years – that showed decisively, and again, if you're following Twitter, I'll try to arrange over the next break to have this posted, but that shows decisively that same-sex unions are troublesome for the children that they care for. It's decisive. And here's how I know the research is good, because the professor or academic who put the research together, they had, once they announced what they found, they had all of their computers and information, everything confiscated by the university that they work for. Because the conclusion, this is true, because the conclusion was so radically politically incorrect.
Yeah.
And when they vetted the entire research, they had to give him everything back because he had done his research well, or the person had. I don't know if it was a woman or a man. And so, you're chuckling because you know what happens when a person says something like that that's wildly politically incorrect. The left is not interested in the truth. They're interested in what turns out to be religious views.
Yeah.
Their leftist religion. And part of leftist religion is sex doesn't matter at all. All that a child needs is two warm bodies, or maybe one warm body, or maybe four or five or six different warm bodies that love him. That's, or her. That's all that's necessary. And common sense shows that to be wrong, but nature shows that to be wrong, and also now the statistics or the study shows it to be wrong. Like I said, over the break, I'll get this information to the enforcer, and she'll. Do you have it already, Melinda? It's like University of Texas or something like that, some Texas school. But I have it on my own computer. I don't have it right in front of me here. So, does that help?
Yes, yes. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
and I encourage everybody to become strategic partners. I just did that today. And
God bless you, Joe. Yeah. Thank you. So that's someone who commits on a regular.
That signed tactic book.
Yes, I'm looking forward to sending it to you, Joe. Okay, we'll be in touch.
Right.
All right, thank you, buddy.
Thank you very much, Greg. Yeah. I'll call back with some more questions later.
Okay, sounds good. Take care.
All right, bye.
That was really great. Let's talk with Chris in Ada, Oklahoma. Hello, Chris.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about kind of orthodoxy in how we talk interdenomination, but then other maybe cults that claim to be Christian.
Yeah.
I myself have recently been introduced to something called Reformed theology. They also call it Calvinism.
Yeah. And very, very familiar with it. And that's not a cult, by the way.
Okay.
Just so you know.
Because that seems to be where I live. That seems to be the reaction I get anytime I tell someone that I'm leaning that way. They step back and they just look at me. And then I find that other denominations come together on this point that, you know, heretical, or they have a strong reaction to
it. Well, let me tell you, if that's heretical, then the heresy goes back to Augustine, because much of Augustine's theology is incorporated into Reformed theology. Not only that, is the Reformation was thick. The Reformation period was thick with this understanding of sovereign grace. And almost everyone before the Civil War who was a Christian in America held to this idea.
Right.
The first Great Awakening in America was led principally by Calvinistic thinking, if you want to use the term, or Reformed thinking. Jonathan Edwards was a Calvinist. The Puritans were all Calvinists. The earliest movements of Christianity in this country were Calvinistic. Now, that doesn't, of course, mean that it's true, but it certainly, I think, raises the question of that at least should help people to see that this is a noble alternative. I mean, it happens to be my own point of view as well when it comes to the issue of salvation. So, you know, I know a cult when I see it, and you know, there's nothing about sovereign grace that qualifies it for that term. People who use terms like that, unfortunately, to describe a view like Calvinism, which they may disagree with and which may not be correct theologically, but people who use that tell me that they do not understand what a cult is. Alan Gomes, who has written extensively on cults and was the editor for the Zondervan Encyclopedia of the Cults, he himself is a Calvinist. Talbot Seminary is Calvinistic in its basic broad understanding of salvation. So, you know, for people to say that this is somehow a cultic point of view is they are not understanding church history accurately, and they certainly are not understanding the word cult accurately. There is no foundational truth of Christianity. The deity of Christ, the two natures of Christ, the blood atonement, the resurrection of Christ, the second coming of Christ, right on down the line. There is no essential doctrine that is denied by Calvinists. It's all part of their view. And so, therefore, since no essential doctrine is denied by Calvinists, they cannot be called a cult. It's as simple as that in terms of definition. Thank you, Chris, for your call. Again, that doesn't mean the Calvinists are right. It just means they can't be wrong in virtue of being a cult. And I actually think in many ways they're right. So that's another discussion. All right. That's it for this hour. Another hour coming right up. And remember, if you don't get that hour in your local broadcast area, you get the podcast so you get all 3 hours of our show. Coming back at you here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us. Well, you had that look in your eye, Tom. It's hard to tell. Tom doesn't point. He just looks at me. Then I'm supposed to know that the mic's on. So I started without him. That's okay. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. My mic is on now. And this is a three-hour show, and as I'm speaking now, it's hour number two. You may have missed hour number one. Maybe this is the only hour that you get on your own broadcast. That's a good reason to podcast the show. Go to str.org or also iTunes. You can sign up. You get the whole thing for free. You never lose it. The last hour, though, there was a call just at the end that I want to make a quick comment on before I get to something else, and that comment is that with regards to Reformed theology or Calvinism, the caller said that he is getting exposed to these notions lately, and the people in his circles have reacted to it like it's a cult. The thing that most people react to, I mean, Reformed theology and Calvinism are both broad theological categories. There's a lot going on. But the thing that they most react to is the notion of sovereign grace, or also could be referred to as unconditional election. That God's choice is an unconditional elective choice to save some and not others. I guess to put it in a crass way, by the kind intention of his will, he determined not to save everybody, but to elect some, and that's the notion of election or predestination with regards to salvation we find in the New Testament. Now, I'm not going to argue the merits of the view. I mean, I personally agree with the view. Many of you know this, but I just wanted to make a clarification, and I had to double-check during the break on this just to make sure I was on the money here. But the Reformation was driven first by Martin Luther. I mean, formally, things happened before him that kind of got things going. But Martin Luther was the match that struck the tinder. So people associate the Reformation with Martin Luther. So Lutheranism is the protest of the Protestants against the Roman Catholics. And then the Protestantism then began to form into two groups, the Lutherans and, the Calvinists, or what were called the Reformed. So the entire Protestant Reformation is really represented by two theological camps, Lutheranism and Calvinism. Now, later on, there were more divisions and people took exception with it, but I just want you to see that as this thing is exploding out and growing, you have these two major camps, certainly, and without controversy, Lutheranism. But Lutherans hold to election as well, unconditional election. And there are differences down the line in the details with Lutherans and Calvinists, and that's why they're two different groups. But I'm just making the point. If the idea of unconditional election is somehow cultish, well, then the Protestant Reformation was started by cults. And then the question is, when did the Protestants get straightened out? I mean, Luther himself wrote the book Bondage of the Will. So anyway, that's just a FYI. I have a little bone to pick here, if I can put it that way. Or let me just register a complaint with the recent statements from the Pope, the new Pope, Pope Francis. And there are different ways this information has come down to me. The first was a missive that came out of Rome, and now I'm looking for the Telegraph out of the UK, a piece by Nick Squires. And the lead here, this September 11th, okay, so it's not quite a month ago, 3 weeks ago. And the piece starts out, Pope Francis reaches out to atheists and agnostics. Well, great. That's a good sign. I reach out to them too. However, it's the way apparently he reached out. The Pope has struck a surprisingly conciliatory tone, the article reads, towards atheists and agnostics. Conciliatory? Saying that God will forgive them as long as they behave morally and live according to their consciousness. Conscience is. Plural for conscience. This unprecedented gesture came as his incoming number two, the Vatican's newly nominated Secretary of State, said... Oh, this is another issue. So here's apparently what he said. God forgives those who obey their conscience. quote unquote. The 76-year-old pontiff was responding to editorials written in July and August by an agnostic in the papers in a newspaper, and in which the Pope was asked through the editorial or the article whether the Christian, quote, the Christian God forgives those who do not believe and do not seek faith, close quote. Now, I really was troubled by this article when I saw it. But, you know, I asked Amy and our staff to find the primary source document because you never know what newspaper writers do with quotes and whether they're using them accurately. And I do not want to misquote anybody, especially a noble religious leader like the Roman Catholic pontiff. And so she was able not only to get the English translation, but she got the Italian for me as well, the original Italian, which I can't read, so I'm going to read you translation in English. And here's what the Pope wrote. He says, I come to three questions that you, this would be the agnostic or atheist, put to me in the article of August 7th. It seems to me that in the first two, what is in your heart is to understand the attitude of the church to those who don't share faith in Christ. Okay, that's the key. So now we're down to it. The attitude of the church towards those who don't share the faith in Jesus. Let me just pause for a moment. Now, those of you who know your New Testament, do you know what the New Testament teaches on this particular question? If you don't, you ought to. I actually did an article on it, 4 years ago or something. You can find it. It's called No Other Name, Part 1 and 2. But the New Testament is quite clear on this. The view theologically is called exclusivism, that those who do not put their faith in Christ are excluded. As harsh as that sounds, you need to know there's a reason for that. And the reason is that if you don't accept the pardon offered through Christ, there is no pardon for you. And you stand in your own sins before God, not forgiven, but guilty. The offer is a free offer, and it's an offer of grace. Here's the pardon. People say no, okay. Either implicitly or explicitly they say no. Well, then you don't have the pardon. That's the New Testament's teaching. That is not the teaching of the Roman Catholic Church, though. I continue then in the citation from the primary source document. That is the words of the Pope himself, and I'm reading the entire paragraph so that I think that I'm getting the point clearly. He continues, what is in your heart is to understand the attitude of the church to those who don't share faith in Jesus. First of all, you ask me if the God of Christians forgives one who doesn't believe and doesn't seek the faith. Premise that, and it's the fundamental thing, the mercy of God has no limits if one turns to him with sincere and contrite heart. Now I agree with that too, as far as it goes. The mercy of God has no limits. And the mercy of God is released to those who turn to him with a sincere and contrite heart, of course. Like the person in the back of the synagogue that was beating his breast and said, God have mercy on me, a sinner. That's what God wants to hear. But then the Pope goes on and he says, the question for one who doesn't believe in God lies in obeying one's conscience. Sin also for those who don't have faith exists when one goes against one's conscience. To listen and to obey it means, in fact, to decide in face of what is perceived as good or evil. And on this decision pivots the goodness or malice of our action. Now, it's too bad there isn't more here, because this doesn't completely answer the question for me, and this is troublesome because this is often the situation when a Roman Catholic Pope kind of addresses questions like this for salvation. They say some things that give an impression, but they don't say, apparently in this, precisely. What it sounds like, he's saying, is what the writer in the Telegraph picked up, the way he summed it up, that if you don't have the faith, you're an atheist or agnostic, well, then God is going to judge you based on how well you keep your conscience, because the conscience is the thing that decides. I mean, the conscience tells you right and wrong, so it's up to you obeying your conscience. Now, at first blush, And actually, even as I think about it, that sounds like the Pope is saying you can believe, you can be an atheist or maybe an agnostic, disregard God, disregard Christ, and still be saved by your goodness. That is, you're doing the best you can to keep your own conscience. Now, here's a couple of quick thoughts on that. Maybe I'm misunderstanding him, but I'm just going by what I see here. This is not a difficult question to answer. The Philippian jailer asked Paul, "What must I do to be saved?" The Paul said, "Believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and you shall be saved." The Jewish leaders commanded John and the apostles soon after the resurrection not to preach the gospel. And they said, Peter said, shall we say the first pope said, "There is salvation in none other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved." Now, Peter did not mean that you can be saved without faith in Christ because of what Jesus did. He didn't mean there's salvation in none other, that is, you have to have Jesus to forgive sins in God's bookkeeping, but you don't have to believe in him. If that were the case, he would have said that. He is facing a lashing by the people who crucified Christ, and he says there is salvation in none other, because they had been preaching Christ. The point I'm making is this: you cannot twist this. This is very clear what he's saying. When Paul was writing to a group like this in Romans chapter 10, first few verses, he said, "I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, that is the Jews, but not in accordance to knowledge. For not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own, they did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God." So I think I'm within my rights here, given the fact that the scripture speaks with crystal clarity on this question. And maybe that raises other questions for you. Fine. But with regards to what the scripture says, it speaks with clarity. The Pope should have spoken with clarity consistent with the scriptures. However, the church itself does not hold the view that one must believe in Jesus to be saved. Their view is called inclusivism. And here it seems even to be extended to atheists and agnostics. That is, you can even reject the existence of God, but if you obey your conscience, then that's going to be the standard by which you're judged, and presumably, it sounds like that may work out for you. Now, if you're always disobeying your conscience, well, then you're in trouble. But if you're basically obeying your conscience, well, then you're still a righteous person, and what, righteous people get into heaven? Well, wait a minute. Didn't Paul say there is none righteous, not even one? Well, that's Romans 3. Yes, he did say that. Gee, what was he getting at? I think he meant there are none righteous, not even one. Not ultimately before God, not ultimately righteous. Every mouth is closed, shut up under sin, that we all might become accountable to God. That's in there too. Now, this is an opportunity for, it seems to me, the leader of over a billion Christians to speak the gospel clearly to somebody, an atheist and agnostic who desperately needs it. But instead, there's equivocation here. That really bothers me. It's not just the Pope either. Tons of Protestants do the same thing. He who does not believe is judged. That's John 3, by the way. Now, that's that famous verse, "For God so loved the world," you know, that's in John 3, where you keep reading. "He who does not believe the wrath of God abides in him," that's in John 3, too. Gee, it doesn't sound like anything like the words here I'm reading from the pontiff. Anyway, just keep that in mind. Okay, I got that off my chest. Well, I really don't understand it, friends. I don't understand it. When the gospel is communicated with such clarity in the scriptures, in the book of Acts, in the book of Romans, and over and over, that we can't give a crystal clear answer to an atheist who is asking about what qualifies for salvation. Can an atheist be forgiven his sin. No. Not as an atheist. An atheist can repent, which means to change one's mind, turn to God, and sue for peace, plead with God to forgive him, beat his breast and say, I am guilty. Lord Jesus, have mercy on me, a sinner. Yes, then they could be forgiven if they're no longer atheists at that point. There is no hope for atheists. There is, and anyone who suggests it is giving a false hope. Don't you see? Oh. All right, let's break early here, and then we'll come back to calls. I'm Greg Kokel, going to break back in just a moment with your calls on Stand to Reason.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Babies have been aborted in the world since 1980. We have an obligation to defend the innocent and vulnerable, and you can learn how to defend the unborn and persuade others effectively and graciously. Stand to Reason's Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to enter any pro-life arena, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with full confidence that your case is solid and your appeal is just. From the comfort of your own home or church, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned plug-and-play course gives you everything you need to train yourself or a group in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through videotapes, workbooks, role-playing, quizzes, and games, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion through the use of graphic visual aids, to simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, to use scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, and to expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric. Please take a stand against abortion and learn how to engage others persuasively and graciously. Visit our online store at str.org to purchase the DVD curriculum Making Abortion Unthinkable, or call Stand to Reason at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON or our online store at str.org.
Show us Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Greg Kokel, and let's get right to the calls here in Michigan. Chris, hi, Chris.
Hi, Greg. How are you doing this evening?
Good, thanks. And where in Michigan are you?
I'm in Northfield, Michigan. I met you at Abdul Murray's fundraiser last year.
Yes, that's right. Good. All right. Super. So you're in the Detroit area. Right. Okay.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I called you a couple times before asking you about some questions I had about Calvinism. I've told you, I've mentioned before that I got a lot of friends that are Calvinists. I still haven't come to that conviction.
Yeah, that's okay.
But I was actually calling because trying to get your perspective on how important Calvinism is, and I'll tell you why. Because I do have a lot of Calvinist friends, mm-hmm. and it's been this way kind of all along, but I guess I've kind of ignored it largely in the past, but lately, a lot of my Calvinist friends on Facebook post these memes where there's, a picture of Calvin, and there's, a quote, the word predestination appears X amount of times in the scripture, that must mean free will, mm-hmm. and, someone posted today Jesus saying, and something to his disciple, picture Jesus talking to the disciple saying, and then God said that I would harden Pharaoh's heart, but then at the bottom it says, well, Pharaoh said, I hardened it already, you're too late. And so one friend told me that I wasn't even a believer, and he unfriended me, but he was kind of a Geneva-only guy. He was a bit extreme, so I kind of...
Well, where does it say in any passage in Scripture, and I'm reformed in my soteriology, as I've mentioned earlier, but where does it say in any passage of Scripture that you have to have a certain understanding of this whole thing in order to be saved, for goodness sake? I mean, that's just so bizarre.
I think the same thing, but like I said, that guy was a bit extreme.
Yeah.
Like I said, he was a Geneva-only guy, but then I have other friends. I have one friend who told me today that he believes that everybody that are genuinely Christians, God will change their hearts to see sovereign grace as monergistic before they die. And then I got these friends that are constantly trying to convert me to Calvinism, mm-hmm, as if it's like an essential tenet of Christianity.
Yeah, well,
I've just been trying to, I don't necessarily subscribe to it. I'm fairly confident. I understand it. I'm turning to you, just trying to get your, because I've tried to reason with these guys and I haven't.
Sure.
Had
well, I something that I have been thinking about a lot lately, I've been noticing in the Scriptures a lot, is the emphasis on peace between Christians. All right? And, for example, one passage that I recently memorized just through overuse, of necessity, it's been helpful to me, and that is in 1 Peter, I think, chapter 2, or maybe it's 3, I memorized the verse, not the numbers. And it said, for all of you, let everything be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil, but blessing instead. For you are called to inherit a blessing. Now, this is great advice to Christians on theological issues about which they differ. I think these discussions are fabulous. We have discussions about weighty theological issues here at Stand to Reason, and I have with other friends of mine. But what is more important than one side or the other kind of winning the theological debate, and I'm not suggesting that these are inconsequential ideas, but what seems more important is that all be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, humble in spirit. I mean, that's great advice. And it's not just there. The New Testament is epistles are thick with that kind of advice, talking about peace between each of us. And so this is the kind of thing that, well, if people are posting things on your website, on your Facebook, that are controversial and that you don't care for, you can do what I did. And that is, on my Facebook, I said, I don't want people coming into my living room and beating up my guests on some theological issue. And I'd have non-Christians come in and start slinging mud, and even Christians start slinging mud about some competing theological issue. And I said, that's not what my Facebook is for. It isn't to hash out all of these theological issues in the kind of acrimonious way that people have gotten used to hashing them out on the internet. I said, none of that. This is my house, and we're not going to have that, period. And so people have stopped doing that, and even when somebody tries to weigh in with a nasty attitude about something, somebody else will step in and say, hey, this is Greg's place, and, mind your manners. And I've appreciated that. So that's cut that down on that. And, in fact, when people don't obey, I just throw them out. I don't throw the person out right away. I just throw the comment out. So there's none of that stuff for people to react to. And if I get to it late and there's about 10 back and forth, I'll just throw the whole lot of the conversation out. Again, I don't unfriend anybody unless they keep doing the same thing over and over. And there was one atheist person that was just making a mess, and so I just unfriended him. Now I have a different kind of Facebook, so anybody can get in there if they want, I think. But that's one way to deal with it.
Okay. And just to be clear, this is a secondary issue. That's my conviction on it, and that's kind of been the approach that I used to take, the approach of of responding to all their questions, and I've gotten to the point where, you know, I don't feel like they genuinely want answers. I think they're genuinely just intending to convert me, and I just haven't. I've listened to R.C. Sproul's lectures on this subject. I just haven't gotten to the point where that's my conviction.
Sure, so yeah, and that's okay.
Of just saying, hey, it's a secondary issue, and I don't have a problem with your position on it. You know, I think that it's just, you know, it's, you know, my interpretation is maybe on certain verses may be different than yours, and they kind of respond with. They kind of respond like their interpretation is infallible. They don't say that, but that's how they imply.
Yeah, right.
Unmistakably only me that's potentially wrong.
Right. Well, look, they could be wrong. You could be wrong. In principle here, we're just these things need to be worked out in discussion if somebody wants to have the discussion. And if somebody doesn't, then I think people should lay off because, as you pointed out, it's, in my view, too, it's a secondary issue. Now, what's important here, though, Chris, is that you have to be clear on what you mean by secondary issue. And here's how I would characterize a secondary issue. Primary issues are ones that relate to the gospel, and if you don't get these primary issues right, then you aren't a Christian. I mean, things like the deity of Christ and the blood atonement and, you know, faith in Christ and the resurrection and things like that. These are things that separate the men from the boys or from the Christian from the non-Christian ideologically. Now, within Christianity, and usually those things are mentioned in the great creeds. What's curious is that the creeds, as I recall, in my understanding, that relate to the issue of these questions don't come around until 1,500 years after Christ. So not that you – when I say creeds, the creeds don't specify that this particular view – is critical until 1,500 years after Christ. And it seems to me if this notion was critical, that very early on they would have discussed this as critical, like they did the person of Christ and the deity of Christ and et cetera. And they didn't. So I think that this can properly be considered a secondary issue.
That's been very comforting because that's one of the hang-ups for me is the fact that it didn't become a real issue until 1,500 years later. But thank you so very much for your commentary tonight. I really appreciate it. You know, I sometimes I feel like I'm going crazy and I just want to bounce things off of people.
Okay. Sometimes
I'm not. You know.
Sometimes I think I'm going crazy, too. So I'll join the club here, Chris. Thank you for your call, though. And just a clarification on this particular issue. When I say it's secondary, I mean that it's unrelated to the issue of salvation. I'm not suggesting it's not important, and these aren't things that we should be talking about. But I don't think salvation hinges on this question. The issue of how God is working in election is largely a question of what's going on behind the scenes. In terms of human activity, the gospel goes forth, it is offered to people, and people can either respond or reject. So on a human level, we know we are making choices. When it comes to the question of Calvinism, that's a discussion about what is behind the choice that we make. And the answer from the Calvinists is that God reinclines our will from rebellion to acceptance. He's wooed in and drawn in by the Holy Spirit. And in virtue of that, he necessarily makes a decision for Christ. That is, simply in virtue of God's election and wooing, that will be brought to definite fruition because God secures that. But notice, that's something that's happening, even in the Calvinistic view, behind the scenes. It's not what's right up and center. You don't have the apostles going forward saying, okay, will the elect please come forward? No, they offer the gospel. And so that's one reason that I can say with confidence it's a secondary issue and that it's not appropriate, I think, for those who are Calvinists to beat up on non-Calvinists in the kind of way that our caller was just expressing, Chris, I think. Just expressing. So we can express the gospel just exactly the way it was expressed in the book of Acts. And that gospel makes no reference to election. It is just after the fact that we get insight onto what's going on. And, of course, this ex post facto reflection, there are going to be differences on what it actually means. But it's ex post facto. It's after the fact of salvation. Therefore, salvation is not dependent on that. Therefore, salvation being the primary thing, this issue is secondary. All right, let's look at the clock. Oh, plenty of time here. Poto, Oklahoma. Poto, Oklahoma. Did I say that right, Jason?
Yeah, Poto.
Sort of?
Yeah, Poto. P-O like plateau, but P-O.
Okay. All right. Well, welcome to the show, Jason.
Hey, I appreciate it. Sure. I tell you, I feel my topic is quite insignificant compared to what you've already been discussing with everybody.
No topic is insignificant on this show.
Yeah, I was listening to your Duck Dynasty podcast earlier at work, and our local Baptist Association is having a men's retreat a week from this Friday, and Jep and Al, the youngest brother and the preacher brother from Duck Dynasty, is going to be there.
Oh, yeah.
That weekend.
Jep is the youngest, Al is the eldest, and I met Al a little more than 2 weeks ago that Saturday morning.
Yeah, he's going to be there doing a gospel presentation. There's like 1,500 men signed up to go over there.
Wow.
Wow. And anyway, Jimmy Houston's going to be there too. So
no kidding.
Well, yeah, I mean, Phil Robertson seems like small potatoes compared to Hank Parker, you know.
Well, you know, Jimmy Houston, I spent some time with Jimmy Houston. What is it, 1993 or 92 when we went to, I'm looking at the enforcer. I think it was 1992, 94. I think this would be before Stand to Reason. Oh, no, maybe not. Maybe it was after. Okay, 1994, right in there sometime. So it's 20
right.
years ago about that. Melinda and I and a bunch of other people that were friends of ours were part of a tour to Israel, and Jimmy Houston was on the tour.
No way. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I do not think he'll remember that, but I got to spend like a week and a half with him. And I was actually supposed to go fishing with him, but it didn't work out. But I did go fishing with Hank Parker. So
I've seen that. I was so jealous. I mean, I've been listening since the late 90s, and, you know, that to me was one of the most exciting things I heard you get involved in.
Well, I appreciate that. My daughters also got excited about the Hank Parker thing, and they got excited about the Phil Robertson thing, too. So that's a funny thing. All right. So
anyway.
Onward and upward here.
Yeah, I'm sitting here looking at my certificate of ordination on my wall in my office. And, you know, I've often wondered about this, and all the years I've listened to you, I haven't heard you address it that I know of. But, you know, what is the purpose of Christian ordination? And I'll kind of set it up by saying, you know, I've been ordained about 10 years now, and, you know, I can marry and bury and do things like that with the state. But I went to my brother-in-law's ordination probably, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, and we were sitting there with the ordaining council, and the question came up about the doctrinal issues and this and that, you know, and one of the pastors there who had been a pastor for a while asked my brother-in-law the question. He said, what would you do if the ordaining council determined that you were not ready for the gospel ministry? And my brother-in-law answers, well, I would probably find out, you know, where I've erred, you know, and go study some more and come back and attempt again. And, you know, and this guy who, you know, at the time I kind of looked up to, he was like, well, you mean that you would just preach the gospel anyway, right? Because you were called.
That was a trick. That was a trick question.
It was a trick question, you know, but, you know, it makes you think. You know, my ordination, it was very few really heavy doctrinal issues. And for the most part, it felt like as long as you're a nice guy and the church likes you, hey, we'll sign you up. So what is the purpose of ordination? Does it have a purpose? Or?
Well, since ordination is not, strictly speaking, I would say, a biblical motif, selecting elders is, going out and you know, being sent out by a local body to serve and make a difference for Christ. I mean, that's a biblical motif. But strictly speaking, ordination, as we understand it, is not. Since it's not a biblical motif, it's not constrained by biblical definitions. And therefore, it can be whatever a local church deems it to be, by and large. It can be something very weighty, or it can be, it's up to them, I guess is what I'm saying, ordination. Now, generally, we have a certain understanding of what ordination entails, and that it is an act that has some gravity to it, and so therefore we don't expect that churches are going to ordain people in a cavalier fashion. But that doesn't mean they don't. I mean, sometimes you can get your ordination papers on the internet. So, yeah. Where were you ordained by the church in the sky type thing? You know, I have my papers from the cloud kind of deal.
Yeah. I guess I was hoping that maybe one of the purposes would be to protect, another church who might receive this man as a pastor, you know, maybe mm-hmm. from false doctrine or from, you know, leanings towards, you know, bad
theology, right? But see, even cultic groups have ordained ministers. So ordination is a kind of a official way of marking somebody as a man of the cloth or a person of the cloth. I actually wrote a couple of things down here. One, the government requires it for certain things. You said marrying and bearing. Well, you have to be ordained in order to do that. And the presumption is that along with ordination comes a certain skill or education that would qualify that person for these sacerdotal duties, you know, these religious duties. And in some cases, ordination is part of a denomination identifying this individual as someone who is adequate to the task of officially representing them. In the capacity of religious leaders.
It seems like more liturgical churches lean more that way.
Sure, yeah. So there's a certain sense in which I think that ordination is a human invention, but I don't mean when I say that we should be dismissive of it. Generally, it has some gravity associated with it that you have to qualify for this position, and then when we learn that people are ordained with very little qualification, then we don't take that ordination seriously. But ordination generally has to do with exhibiting within the context of a local group, organization, congregation, or denomination, a certain skill adequate to the task of fulfilling significant spiritual responsibility. And so somebody might say, you know, we can't ordain you because we don't think that your views reflect ours. So to be ordained in our denomination, that would be inappropriate. Some might say, we're not going to ordain you, that is, lift you to a position of public spiritual leadership because we don't think you have the qualifications for that as described in Titus and 1 Timothy. Titus 1 and 1 Timothy chapter 1 and,
right.
or
and I
chapter
guess
2.
Whenever you look at those qualifications, it seems like a lot of them are, you know, regards to their character, integrity.
They're almost
versus the their doctrinal knowledge.
Well, there is a requirement for that. All of the requirements are character requirements except for one, and that is that you have to be able to teach in sound doctrine and refute those who contradict. I think that's the way it's put in Titus. So there is a skill requirement, but it's doctrinal. And so if somebody's being chosen for spiritual leadership in the church and he doesn't have those requirements, both character and doctrinal skill, able to teach, then they should not be elevated to that position. That would be contrary to Scripture.
Right. I guess it just put me off guard with that pastor, older pastor saying, well, you should go preach anyway because you're called.
Well,
you know,
I was thinking the same thing, though. I was thinking that's what I would say. I don't need a committee's permission to go out and fulfill the Great Commission. I don't need that. Now, I may need the committee's permission to be part of their denomination in an official capacity, but not to do that. And I guess if I had been asked the same question, I might say, well, I don't need your permission. I'm saying respectfully, sir, but I don't need your permission to fulfill the Great Commission. I can do that without, all I need is the Holy Spirit and the truth, and I can
participate. So ordination is not tied necessarily to the role of a pastor.
Well, I thought you were going to, I actually thought you were going to say it's not tied necessarily to the communication of the gospel, because that's the question he asked.
No, I guess I was thinking that it was tied to the role of a pastor.
It is characteristically tied to a pastor, but you can be, you could, a denomination could say, we're not ready yet to qualify you as a pastor, but you can still participate in the ministry of the gospel, which is communicating the good news.
Right, I understand that.
So I agree in principle with the old guy's point, you know, it was a trick question, because he was hoping the guy, your brother, whoever it was, would say, listen, I can, even as a brand new Christian, I can participate in the gospel program. I'm looking for something more, and that's why I'm here, something along those lines. But, all righty?
Yeah, I understand what you said. Okay, well, I do appreciate your time. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, me too, you, Jason. Thank you for the call. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back to more calls on Stand to Reason.
I have a suggestion for you. Subscribe to STR's monthly publications, Solid Ground and Greg's Mentoring Letter. Just go to str.org and click on the subscription button at the top of the page. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. We'll send you the bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, that Greg Kokel writes on an in-depth subject, free for a year. We'll also send you his bi-monthly mentoring letter that he writes on practical skills you need to be an ambassador for Christ. These are no ordinary newsletters. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ for free. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like why the Bible is reliable, evolution, abortion, timely issues, so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador for Christ on key issues you will be challenged on. You can go to str.org, subscribe to the e-news to receive Solid Ground and the mentoring letter.
Don't forget, Stand to Reason's live broadcast is Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. on the web. That's Pacific time, by the way. So go to str.org to listen live, or use your STR app to stream it live. You can also give me a piece of your mind by calling at that time, Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number, 855-243-9975. And, of course, you can listen on the radio, like always, on Sundays, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. But for the live broadcast, tune in online Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time, by going to str.org. All right, back to work here. Greg Kokel and Michael in Miami, Florida. Hold on, let me get it. Michael, is that you? Michael? Michael in Miami.
I'm here.
Okay, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, Mike. You got a tough question here.
Yeah. I want to first, again, thank you for your ministry. I mean, it has meant a lot in my life, and is. I'll explain even personally. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, my call is kind of a personal one, Greg.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I did want to say that I want to God rewarded me with a very good job recently. I'm looking forward to becoming a partner.
Strategic partner, great.
Strategic partner, absolutely.
That's super.
So if I mean, yes, the check hasn't come in yet. I'm excited to do so.
Thank you.
So, just kind of going to the question.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I've had, a falling out with the wife, with my wife, mm-hmm. and a spiritual question has been coming up for me: when is it appropriate to get a divorce?
Mm-hmm.
And if I can kind of give you a little bit of background, because I know it's just a vague question.
Well, can I ask a favor,
sure.
Mike?
Sure.
The liability I run into here is kind of giving you, even if you're able to give me some background on your personal situation, I'd end up being kind of counseling you on a really heavy issue
yeah.
that I actually will not be able to have enough information to respond to. So can I just respond to the question more in the abstract, and then you could decide on how it applies to you? Would that be all right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the question that you are asking is essentially, when is it okay to divorce, or when is it, permitted to divorce? I'll tell you, I have I have a basic understanding about this. I'm just going to speak in general, and then I'm going to speak in specifics. And Jesus, when he addressed the issue of marriage, and I can't remember, Matthew 19. Here we go.
19, yeah,
Matthew 19. He addressed the issue, and he explained that what God's intention was is to join a man and a woman together for life.
And absolutely.
And this is the vow that most men and women take. I don't know if they do that nowadays, but that was the vow that I took. And until death do us part is the way the vow goes. Now, I took that vow because I believe that is what God wanted for marriage. And I take the vow seriously. Now, I'm just like any other married man, I know there are times when that's a challenge. And it's a challenge for virtually every single married woman as well, okay? But as C.S. Lewis points out, that the point of the vow is to keep a marriage together when it's difficult. He said you don't need a vow when everything's rosy. You don't need a vow to say I'll stay together as long as I love you or I feel good or I'm enjoying myself, because you're going to stay together anyway without the vow. The vow is operative when everything else tells you to run.
Yeah.
So that is the broad basic foundation. And then Jesus adds to it in Matthew 19 by saying, if you divorce a woman for any reason other than adultery, then you've committed adultery yourself, or you force her into adultery. And the disciples freaked out. They said, oh, my gosh, maybe it's better, I'm paraphrasing now, maybe it's better not to get married. And he said, well, okay, some people can handle that, some people can't. But you notice Jesus didn't work to soften it. So whatever perspective that we take biblically on divorce, marriage and divorce, it has got to be severe enough that people say, oh, my gosh, that is really radical. Because this is the way the disciples responded to Jesus' comment, and they were not in the context of a permissive culture on the issue of a divorce. In a much less permissive culture, they still thought that Jesus' perspective was radical. So I think something, whatever our view turns out to be, if it's not the kind of thing that makes you shake your head and say, gosh, if them's the rules, then maybe I shouldn't even get married. If you're not saying that, then you're probably not seeing it the way Jesus saw it. So that's the first general principle. The specifics, though, Jesus seems to indicate in that passage, if there is adultery in the relationship, this is such a significant assault on the union that it can be grounds for dissolution of the union. It doesn't have to be, but it could be grounds for that. Now, there are mixed opinions about that, but that's the view that I have. There's one other thing I'll say from 1 Corinthians, but go ahead. Did you want to jump in?
Well, see, that's the issue. I was reading from the King James Bible, and that's something I've been praying on, and that very verse that you came at me, and I understand the very seriousness of divorce, and I won't go into it, and I'm not asking for counseling.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason I called you one, because in a way, yes, you seek wise counseling, but
yeah, the abundance of counselors, there's
victory. That, I mean, I hate to parse words here, and I was reading from not the King James, the New International Version, which is not my favorite. I prefer English Standard, but
uh-huh.
I was reading it, and it used the term, I can't remember.
Well,
the
Greek term is porneia, I think, and so it is it's a little bit broader term than the one we use to describe adultery. So some other things may qualify for porneia without other than just actual intercourse, to put it simply.
Okay.
I can't go. I don't know enough about it to be able to get more detailed than that.
No,
I just do know
it's
a broader. It is a broader word there. Yeah. So. What I was going to say is that 1 Corinthians also indicates, this is 1 Corinthians chapter 7, I believe, and there Paul talks at length about marriage and being single, and he makes it clear, if you're single, you know, you can, you have more freedom to minister, to serve, to work, but you can't have sex. If you're married, you can have sex, but you can't get divorced, you know, and if you do separate, then you have to be reunited. So there is a place for a separation, but it's meant to be therapeutic. If a Christian couple gets divorced, they shouldn't get remarried except for each other. I mean, that seems to be what Paul's getting at there. And again, it's a severe statement in light of what our values are at the moment in our culture. He did say the exception is if a non-believer leaves the believer, then the believer is not under obligation. And I take that to mean that they are not required to, that they are not constrained by that prior marriage. So I think he said that because there were non-believers in which one member of the marriage would become a Christian, and that itself was enough to divide the family, and the non-believing spouse just abandoned their believing spouse. And Paul says, I've called you to peace. You're not under obligation there. So you can look at it yourself in 1 Corinthians 7. So those are a couple of the standard reasons when it would be biblically allowed to divorce. But that would also mean then that most of the divorces are not biblically sound because they're like irreconcilable differences and that kind of stuff. And I think that if people really, really understood they could not get out of their marriage, they couldn't avoid the problems they're having by divorce, they would either not get married to the person they got married to. In other words, if they were really if they had a high view of marriage from the outset, they would be more careful in the choosing. And secondly, they would be forced to deal with the things in the marriage that needed to be addressed. And many, many people can tell you that their marriage is much, much better now because of the hardship they endured that God allowed them to go through to make them more like Him and to make their marriage right. God uses the sharpest instruments for His surgery on Christians, and those most intimate relationships are among the sharpest of instruments. I don't want to speak to your specific situation, but I understand that relationships can be very, very difficult. Yet at the same time, these are the things that God finds most powerful to use us to conform us to the image of His Son. And so if there are fallings out and difficulties, my advice is to stay in the game and ask God, what do I need to learn through this experience? Mm-hmm. Can I recommend a book for you?
Yeah.
And I don't recommend it lightly, but it's not a frivolous book. It's simply called Sacred Marriage. Sacred Marriage. And the subtitle says something like, maybe God designed marriage to make us holy, not to make us happy. So just something to think about. Okay, Mike?
Yeah, I really thank you for this, Greg. It means a lot. And not just in building me up intellectually and apologetic, but these little things are big. Another thing that you helped me with was forgiveness. Your understanding of forgiveness, I think, is right on the money.
Thank you.
You know, conditional forgiveness and with an open offer of forgiveness. So, thank you again, Greg.
Yeah, you're welcome, and it's good talking to you, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
You know, something that I think Michael was touching there on at the end was that my goal in this show is not just to educate but to mentor. And I don't really think of myself as a pastor, and I don't think it would all be fair to say that I had a pastor's heart, because I know people with pastor's hearts, and I'm nothing like them. I tip my hat to them because that's a tough job. My brother is a pastor with a pastor's heart and a pastor's gift. I should say gifts. And he is a genuine true shepherd to a flock, and my flock is not in front of me. My flock is, I mean, not on an ongoing basis. And so that's the hardest flock to serve. But I have a larger flock that I have much less personal contact with that I do serve somewhat in a pastoral role. And I take that seriously. When I speak at events, I give people an opportunity to sign up for Solid Ground, go to our website, listen to our podcast and the like, because I tell them, I want to mentor you. Now, it's an arm's length mentoring, and you hear, learn more of me than I do of you. In fact, most of you I learn nothing about unless I happen to go to an event in your town and you say hi to me like some fine people did last weekend when I was in Asheville, North Carolina, and thank me for the mentoring all these years that they have received, even though I didn't know they were receiving it. And that's the mystery of this kind of enterprise with the internet and radio and the like. But it's deeply satisfying to me to know that that's happening. And so my desire is not to throw information at you. At Stand to Reason, we are trying to build a kind of person, and that person we call an ambassador. So we're looking in an incarnational approach to representing Christianity. An ambassador has knowledge, an accurately informed mind, but there's wisdom and character too, wisdom and artful method, and character and attractive manner. That is, the whole person is kind of captured in this vision. And so, and this is something that's developed with me in terms of my radio activity over the years. I think early on I was really into giving information, and that's kind of the way I kind of got my feet wet in this enterprise. But as time has gone on, and certainly the last 15 years or so, I've seen more and more the role that I play in others' lives as mentoring. And so I want to go beyond that. And if I can give advice and counsel to some degree, obviously I can't give too much counsel on really tough issues like a person's marriage and divorce and stuff like that. But I can offer the knowledge in a way that would be of pastoral importance to you. And I think that's a little bit what my caller was getting at, and I was glad to be able to help out. All right, we've got another hour to go, and I'll be back after the break. I'm Greg Kokel. You're listening to Stand to Reason. All right, friends, final hour here on Stand to Reason. And I say final hour because we've already had two, which means if this is your first hour, it's your final hour, but you missed two. And it might be that your a radio station that you catch this show on, you know, only carries 1 hour or whatever. I suggest you podcast. Simply put, sign up for the podcast for the full 3 hour show. And in some markets, we've been cutting back, and this has to do with the decisions sometimes that we're not involved with. So, if you've heard 3 hours and now you only have 2 hours, that means you're losing an hour. We always do 3 hours. If you had 2 hours and now you only have 1 hour, now you're losing 2 hours. And you were losing an hour before. So the best thing is just to sign up for the podcast. Go to str.org, sign up there, or go to iTunes and you can get it there. I know Melinda's looking at me like, did you do the math right on that? All right, let's go to the calls. And in Dallas, Texas, Dan, welcome to Stand to Reason, Dan.
Hello, Greg. Thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I wanted to first off to say thank you for, you mentioned in your last segment just how much of a mentor you've been to a lot of people, and you've definitely played that role in my life. And
great.
So I wanted to personally thank you before I ask my question.
Great. You're welcome. Very welcome.
So my question deals with a professor I have at a secular university in a sociology class, and he's teaching about sexuality. And he makes a distinction between the idea of sex versus gender.
Uh-huh.
That sex is, he says that sex is just a biological distinction, whereas gender is like a trait or a social position that is attributed to females and males. So he distinguishes the two. I'm trying to find some good arguments against him, or at least to make him think a little bit on that. Because in my mind, it doesn't seem like that gender, the idea of gender seems false, in my opinion. But
mm-hmm. Well, gender, there's a little bit of truth in what he says, but I'm going to qualify it severely because I'm not at all in his camp. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sex relates to the physical body, the biological condition. All right. Gender can be properly understood as one's mental, orientation with regards to sex. Now, the reason I want to distinguish, it used to be, by the way, that they were basic, almost essentially synonymous,
mm-hmm.
that gender and sex were the same. Okay. And now it's distinguished, I think, somewhat for the wrong reasons, but I was offering the distinction between mental and physical because the distinction actually is legitimate. Homosexuals, for example, have a gender confusion. That is, they are, in the case of male homosexuals, they are biologically male, but they are exhibiting the characteristics of the gender of a female when they are sexually attracted to males. The natural condition is for males to be attracted to females and vice versa. When males are sexually attracted to males, and I think just now in natural terms, we're not even going to get theological about it for the moment. And
right.
I don't think you need to either in your class.
Yeah.
But think for a moment the natural condition. The idea of a male being sexually attracted to another male is borderline incoherent because it is not the sex that they can successfully have sex with. That is, they cannot join together for the purpose of procreating, which is nature's purpose for sex.
Mm-hmm.
So there is confusion there.
Mm-hmm. But what if they argue that they disagree with that foundational principle about sex? That it is at the foundational level for propagating the species, so to speak. So if they disagree with that,
Well, I'm just assuming that they're naturalists then.
Right,
the natural impulse for sex is for what natural purpose? That's the question to ask.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The natural purpose seems to be for reproduction. So I am just trying to keep theology out of it and just look at the natural order and say, gee, the natural state is that gender and sex be the same. So if you have a male body, then the natural state would be to have male gender identity so that then you can use your male body to do what it was in a certain sense, and I'm not using theological terms here, just designed by nature to do, and that is to mate with a female. So your sexual desires are matching your sexual body. Okay?
Okay,
so now what happens when in human beings a male has a female sexual desire? Well, that's confusion. That is, their mental state does not match their physical state. Mm-hmm. Now, in order for that to happen, then you have to have a distinction between the two. You have to have a physical state, which we call sex, and you have to have a mental state, which is different from it, which we're going to call gender. And this is why I think the distinction is legitimate. The basic distinction is legitimate because this is what happens in homosexuals. They have a gender identity that does not match their physical sex. Okay?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, there's another step to this. I'm just explaining why I think the distinction is legitimate as far as we've gone.
Okay.
Did you want to jump in with a comment?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Now, here's the second point. I have suggested that the gender and sex be the same as a normative condition. In other words, this is the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
And if it's not like that, something's wrong. What they want to say is there's nothing wrong whatsoever with having a gender that is different from your sex.
Mm-hmm.
But now, in fact, you could even celebrate it. This is why people say that they're a woman on the inside and a man on the outside. And so what they want to do then is they want to mutilate their body to match the inside.
All right.
And I've always wondered, if something is amiss, and this is intrinsic in transsexualism, that something's wrong. It's intrinsic in the issue. This is why people want to cut their body. They want to have surgery. They want to take hormones because something is wrong. Something isn't matching.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is not like a clever, quick answer for your professor, but I'm just trying to lay the foundation here. If something is wrong, why would somebody think that their body is wrong and not their mind?
Right. And then also, I mean, even whenever they do cut themselves and try and change their physical appearance, they're still not changing their biology.
They're not changing their biology. They're
but
not
their DNA
all.
Still stays whether they're male or female.
Sex change operations are not possible.
Right.
Period.
Right.
Yes, you can be castrated. Yes, you can sew things onto your body. Yes, you can take hormones and you develop breasts and the like, but you cannot change your sex. Sex change operations are not possible. Mm-hmm. All you can do is mimic. And so maybe this is the way to get at it now as I'm working through this. So you can ask yourself, the professor, the question, okay, does the notion of transsexualism, the idea that there's a woman in a man's body who then wants to have an operation, doesn't that implicitly suggest that something's wrong? Now you could say, and the reason I defend the notion that implicitly something's wrong is because they want to change it to make it the same.
Right.
The whole goal is to make the gender and the sex match up. Because they don't match. Clearly, they don't match, okay? And those who want to get change, the transsexuals at least, not homosexuals, because that's a different enterprise, even though the same kind of thing is going on, I think, gender confusion. Doesn't that imply that they think that something's wrong and they're trying to fix it? Okay, so if they think something's wrong and they're trying to fix it, why would we assume that the body's wrong and not the mind? That the sex is wrong and not the gender perception.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's a fair question too. I actually do not think you're going to get very far in this, because I think that your professor is going to do his best to have you for lunch, because they are deeply committed to this notion. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I think you're correct in that assumption. In small dialogues in the conversation, I've disagreed with him, and because of that disagreement, have been just called like intolerant. Because I don't agree with that viewpoint.
Yeah, you can ask him, by the way, when he does that, why won't they tolerate your point of view?
When
offered graciously and respectfully, why do they resort to name-calling and hate speech?
Right.
Just try that. I mean, I'd be curious. I hope people are trying that, because I suggested that the first hour. Why do they resort to hate speech and intolerance when they hear a view that they don't like? Mm-hmm. Especially if you are being respectful, Dan, which I'm sure you are. That's the question. You kind of hold their feet to the fire and see what they have to say. But I want to suggest that you read something. Do you know who Nancy Piercy is?
Oh, yes. Okay. I have her book, Total Truth.
Well, good. The Piercy Report is something you can get on the Internet.
Okay.
And the piercyreport.com, and her last name is spelled P-E-A-R-C-E-Y.
Okay.
So piercyreport.com. And she just recently, this is September 17th, she actually sent me this last week. We had some personal conversation about it. And this is titled Transgender Politics Versus the Facts of Life. And it's an excellent piece. Those that are on Twitter, the Enforcer just posted it there.
Okay.
So this is an excellent article that in the next few weeks, I'm going to try to respond to. But what she points out, what happens with this approach, and this might be some fodder for your discussion with your professor, is what this approach does is it alienates people from their bodies. It breaks them up into little alienated pieces, not whole pieces, alienated pieces, as if they can just, that gender is something you can define and redefine willy-nilly whenever you want. In fact, there was some discussion in her article about how people want it to be so you can be a woman in the morning and a man in the evening. Whatever you want. Complete freedom. And she discusses about how tragic this is to the human psyche because it fractures the psyche. The reality of the fact is that we have bodies that are supposed to be consistent with our gender. Not bodies that are completely unrelated. If our bodies are unrelated to our mental gender, then we have fractured ourselves.
Seems counterproductive.
Yes. Well, it doesn't seem healthy, does it?
No, not at all.
So anyway, I just if you read that article, that might suggest to you some angles that you might pursue in this conversation. But if you get beat up by these people, you can ask them. You always mind your manners and then ask them, why is it when I raise a legitimate question that you respond with name-calling and intolerance? Why is it you do that? And see what they say. Do you think that ridicule is an appropriate – you can ask them this. Do you think that ridicule is an appropriate way of dealing with an alternate view? And if you don't, then why do you keep doing it?
Mm-hmm.
And what's ironic is I bet you the professor is engaging in this as well.
Yeah, a few times.
Yeah, it's pathetic. It is so dishonorable. It's intellectually dishonorable. This professor knows what an ad hominem is, and if it were ever used against him, he'd bark, he'd cry foul immediately. Yet he doesn't have he doesn't have any qualms about using it himself when some politically incorrect person gets in his way. It's disgusting to me.
Well, Greg, I appreciate your response, and that gives me a few things to chew on. Just as a last side note, I wanted to also recommend your book, Tactics, to any listeners out there. It's been phenomenal in my own personal life, so kudos
thanks.
To you on that. It's
okay,
been a phenomenal
book. Dan, I received that. Thank you. I just read the Proverbs the other day. It says, let another praise you and not your own lips. So that means let another praise you, doesn't it, right? Okay, so I thank you for that and appreciate it. And the best, take a look at Nancy Piercy's report on transgender politics.
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
All right, buddy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You guys can get that. I like Nancy Piercy a lot. I like her as a woman and a person. She's a fabulous individual. We've had some sweet time conversations together, and she's just, I know she's a fan of Stand to Reason. I'm a fan of hers. So I encourage you to get the Pearcy Report at PearcyReport.com. Once again, P-E-A-R, as in pair, P-E-A-R-C-E-Y, for Nancy Pearcy. In fact, my wife and I have talked that we would like our daughter Annabeth to want to model herself after Nancy Pearcy. So we'll see if that works out. I don't know. But let's take a break, and I'll get back to more of your calls after that.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kokel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study the Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting STR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order the Bible Fast Forward.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
All right, back at you here, Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind. And in case, just so I don't forget, you know, bad worldviews, no matter how fervently believe, cannot undo reality. And that's why no matter who you're talking with, and that would even be postmoderns, reality can be your ally. And if that's a novel idea, then I want you to take a look at our featured article this week, Worldviews and Reality at str.org, because I go into some detail about how reality can be your ally. So check that out. Okay, let's go to Troy, Michigan, and talk with Steve. Hello, Steve. Steve, you there? Oh, I still want to answer your question. Steve.
Greg, are you there?
Yeah, there you go. Did you have me on mute?
You bet. Sorry.
All right, you're not the first guy to do that.
So, all right, that makes me feel better.
Well, you're the second guy.
Okay.
All right, what's
that? I'm in an elite crowd. Then.
Yeah, there you go. See, you know, you make something good out of it.
Go. Okay, so the person who took the call kind of chuckled when I gave the question. I think it might be an easy one, but if you can think of something harder and then go ahead and thoroughly answer it, that would be great. I'm just trying to prepare for a class tomorrow that I need to facilitate or present in.
Okay.
And the topic is the Bible reliable, which is pretty broad.
Uh-huh. Where is this class?
It's in a church in Troy, or actually in Birmingham, Michigan.
Okay, so it's a Christian audience.
You bet, yeah.
Okay.
So the goal of the class, though, is to be able to respond to skeptics and kind of do it in a concise and persuasive and always loving way.
Okay, good for you. One other question, though. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be pedantic, but what do you mean by reliable?
Reliable, it's just in the broadest sense of the term, like true. And so I think what we want to do in the class is dial it into something more specific, like are the Gospels true, and I think I can cover certain objections well, but others I feel a little more exposed on.
Okay, can I make a suggestion, though?
Yeah.
Even the word true is ambiguous because you could mean historically true, you could mean true with regards to the theological claims. And in since the theological claims are grounded on historical events, I think that the better way to approach it, at least initially, is to ask the question, are the Gospels historically reliable? And this does relate, by the way, to your question, as I understand
right.
it, you're going to
yeah.
ask it. So yeah. that zeroes in a little bit more. Are they historically reliable? Because if we can demonstrate they're historically reliable, then we can see the things, you know, the broad strokes, at least, we can depend on the things that Jesus said and claimed and did. And since every gospel witness is a supernatural witness, if they're historically reliable, then we have reasons to take seriously the claims that Jesus worked wonders. And so this becomes the foundation then for a broader question, are the gospels true in a theological sense? So there's a pecking order there, and the pecking order is, are they true historically? And then are they true theologically? And if we can show they're true historically, then we're really in a good position to then move to the theological claims, grounding them in the person and the work of Christ historically. If we don't do that, then we're up in the air. So I think if you wanted to make it more precise, are the Gospels true or are they reliable? I think if you put the adjective historically in front of them, then you would... Or that would be
yeah.
an adverb, I guess. But
yeah, so specifically, maybe you could address, and this is what I mentioned to the lady answering the phone, did the authors of the Gospels lie?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I understand that, you know, if we've got, like, early dating of the writing
yeah.
and a faithful transmission
right.
of the text through history, then that closes a lot of doors to the
yes.
skeptic. But by the time, you know, you get back to time zero when they were first written, you know, who's to say they didn't write a lie? Say
well, wait a minute. Okay, let me answer that. And I'm just reacting a little bit. And I know you're voicing the questions of others when you say who's to say. I hate that phrase, who's to say, because it results in utter complete skepticism the way it's worded. So the answer to who's to say is the person with the best reasons gets to say. So that's the answer
right.
to that. So then, now right. let's talk about the reasons, okay?
I agree, a burden of proof thing, that's what you're saying.
Well, it's not
they're,
so...
They're shifting an unbearable burden of proof on the Christian.
Well, yeah, that's kind of... When they say who's to say, it just like... what they really mean is nobody has any right to say anything about these with any confidence. Nobody can say it's a complete... jump ball up for grabs. Well, that is not the way historians treat the New Testament documents, particularly the Gospels. They don't think it's a who's to say. You look at you know, the Story of Civilization, which is the best-selling work in history on history, and there's a whole volume dedicated to Caesar and the Christ. You know, and so I mean, the historians take these documents seriously as source of information. So the who's to say business, that thing ought to be, you know, people who say that ought to be drawn and quartered. You know, that should be a capital crime if I were making the laws, if somebody says who's to say. No, the answer is whoever has the best reasons gets to say. So let's see what the most reasonable answer to the question that's being posed is. And the question is, that did the disciples lie? Okay, now I have a question regarding the question. Why would they lie? First, what evidence is there that they told a lie? Secondly, what would motivate them to lie? These are very important questions that you have to ask regarding the claim that maybe they lied. What is the evidence that they lied? Do we have any corroborating information that... or any other information that corroborates their testimony? Well, we do. We have four separate accounts that corroborate each other. And then we have other details from history that offers corroboration. So where is the evidence of the lie? That's the first question. Where is
right.
the evidence? And this, somebody has to come up with that. They can't just say, well, who's to say? Who's to say? You know, I could say to that guy, who's to say you even exist? So I'm just going to ignore you. Well, of course I exist. I'm asking the question, who are you talking to if I don't exist? Well, that's a good response. So you must be somebody. All right. Same thing here. You know, you can't just say, well, maybe they lied. No, you have to ask the question, what is the evidence that they lied? And if there is no evidence, why assume they might be lying? Further, second question, why would they lie? What would be their motivation?
Let's say they wanted to get famous. So, like, somebody that does crop circles or something like that, they want to put one over on the world.
Okay, and how is it possible for dust crop circles to make somebody famous?
Well, not the...
Let's just use that illustration for the moment. Let's just use that, okay? Let's go with that, because this is a good point, actually. How is it possible? Well, it's possible because we have airplanes and we have TVs and we have internet and all that other stuff, and in an instant, those things can be broadcast all over the world, right? So one could see how somebody might make crop circles like that with the goal of getting at least their crop circles broadcast around the world, because that's possible, that you can see the chain of events. Okay, so now let's ask the same question with regards to the disciples. The disciples write the gospel with the expectation that they'll be famous. Why would anyone in the first century think that if they wrote the gospels, this would make them famous?
Well, again, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of the skeptic. I would never try to defend this, but just to try to play that part. They revered Jesus, right?
Who
and
did?
The disciples.
Yeah, of course,
the gospel,
yeah, right.
And they wanted to immortalize him, and they're unremovably tied to him, you know, because
okay.
of their discipleship and living with him.
Yeah.
And so they kind of get the glory by, you know, coattails glory, so to speak.
Okay, let's see. The coattails glory. So the glory Jesus got was what? Crucifixion.
Being a popular teacher. No,
the people clamored for his execution. The people clamored for his execution, and he was duly executed in a brutal way by the Romans. So why? Tell me, where's the glorious coattails there?
Well, you know, coming into Jerusalem, it was much better.
Yes, there was a crowd that laid down those things,
and
a week later,
5,000. But
if we're going to take the account of the feeding of the 5,000 seriously, we have to take the account seriously, because at the end of the account, what happened to all those people? At the end of the account, they left. John 6. Okay. At the end, they left.
Okay.
They left. Not only did they leave, but so did his disciples. A massive number of those who had believed in him left him, because they did not like what he said. He said, you must drink my blood and eat my flesh. They said, oh, gross me out. I'm out of here. And they went. That's in the text. So if we're going to take the account seriously, the point, I'm just going to keep coming back to the same point. Where were the glorious coattails? There were none. The story that the disciples had to deliver was a lie. If Jesus, who did not arise from the dead and all that, they wrote the Gospels so that they would tell a lie and become famous like their predecessor, who just got executed and was buried in a shallow grave and probably eaten by dogs, according to the custom of the Romans and the cemeteries at that time. So why would we think? These guys were shaken in their boots. They denied Christ. All of
right.
that stuff, you know. So why would we think that they'd... Why would we think, oh, well, now we're going to transform this. Everybody's going to like us when we tell these stories about Jesus. Now they're going to do different than they did to Jesus. They're going to like us, and we're going to be famous, whatever that means. You know, now you can be famous by writing a book, but you know how much paper cost back then? You had to write it by hand, and paper was handmade. So it isn't like you can get, I'm a popular author, you know. There were hardly any such thing as a popular author back then. A handful.
Right, right.
Of Greeks.
So no evidence. No, there's no. So there's no evidence of lies. I get that. And
there's no reasonable rationale for them to lie.
You can imagine a hypothetical scenario where a popular leader who died would have, you know, people that tried to put some extra
I can't.
But not based on the teachings of Christ, because Christ's teachings were antithetical.
Yes, that's true. That's a good point. But it's worse than that. You've got to do more than imagine a hypothetical. You've got to give evidence that it actually happened that way.
Right.
And the fact is that the Christians in the first three centuries were brutally murdered. I mean, this was the characteristically, people did not like what the disciples did. They killed them.
Right.
The simple response to the skeptic is that who raises this possibility is the skeptic is not skeptical enough. Because this possibility is ludicrous as an actuality. It's wildly implausible. It may be possible, but it's not wildly implausible. So why would any reasonable person opt for that? There's not a bit of evidence that they were motivated, that they did lie, first, and secondly, that they were motivated to lie out of some hope for fame and glory. There's nothing consistent with the story. Go ahead.
The skeptic living today, you know, drives by a church, sees that it's named St. Paul, and thinks, wow, that guy's famous. He had a big impact, but it would be anachronistic or kind of reading the present results into the past to think that mm-hmm. he was seeking that or could have imagined mm-hmm. that type of result. And in fact, he might.
It's absolutely true. Not only that, even if they could imagine that it might be possible, would you? I mean, would the normal person just think, maybe these guys were extraordinarily weird, but I wouldn't want to go through the kind of persecution and suffering that they went through for a lie, just so I'd have the hope that in 2,000 years somebody would name a building after me. I mean, come on. It doesn't make any sense. Again, they're not skeptical enough.
I'm just trying to tie up loose ends for
you've done a very good job. And this is exactly how we ought to do it. We got to play each other's side, and then we've got to offer the best shot that we can give, and then we got to think it through and see if it works. And in this case, you did a great job as the skeptic, and you did no better than the skeptic would normally do.
Well, thank God.
All righty.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, sure. Steve, keep up the good work.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. Let's go to, let's see, that would be three here. Brett in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Brett.
Hey, how you doing, Greg Coco?
Good.
Been a long time.
I guess so. Have we talked before?
Oh, yeah, Brett Strong.
Oh, okay.
I'm your buddy.
Oh, yeah, okay. I'll never forget what's his name.
I have time for your next break. Last week I was on radio talking to your buddy Frank Turk.
Uh-huh.
And he was taking tough questions, and I called in and said, this is my tough question for you. Can you prove hell exists? And he's like, well, what do you mean about hell exists? Well, you know, and I was like, well, you know, prove it. You know, show it to me, whatever. And he goes, well, we do have a lot of testimony. I go, what kind of testimony do you have about hell? He says, the testimony of Jesus, testimony of Paul. I go, well, how do you know we have the testimony of Jesus and Paul? He goes, oh, it's a fact that we have the words of Jesus and the words of Paul. And I said, Frank Turk, the last time I checked, and you know this, we don't have any first-century documents. And he says, okay, Brett Strong, you're right, but we do have first-century testimony. And I go, no, you have to assume that we have first-century testimony about Jesus and Paul. It's an assumption.
Just for clarification, it depends what you mean by assumption. If what you're doing is you're following a line of argument to a conclusion that's justified by the evidence, it's not an assumption. You're claiming it, at least in the way you're putting it now, as an assumption, which sounds like you're just pulling it out of thin air.
Yeah, that isn't the way it's done. Ultimately, for Frank Turk to say, or anyone to say on earth, that we have the words of Jesus and Paul.
No, it's not.
That's a guess.
No,
that's
just
imagining.
Okay, well, wait. That is precisely the kind of thing that's at issue, and you can't just declare it so. Just to claim that it's a guess because it happened 2,000 years ago. A guess is just a shot in the dark.
And that's a shot in the dark.
Well, okay, that might be your assessment. That might be your assessment of the evidence, but that there's a lot more to it than just a shot in the dark. We have lots of information from the past, hundreds of years ago, even thousands of years ago, that's been handed down, less from thousands as for hundreds, but we have the Gettysburg Address. Now, I mean, when did that happen? That 100 and some years ago. So that happened a long time ago. Is that just a guess? Well, no, we had people record that, and then it was broadcast to other people. I mean, broadcast in terms of passing the information around, not broadcast like by radio. And so when we say that Lincoln said certain words at the Gettysburg Address, we have a lot of information to fall back on that is evidence that it actually took place that way. And therefore, it's not just a guess, it's a conclusion from the evidence.
Okay, but the big difference is, this is where I think you're confusing apples and oranges. When you go back to the first century, Jesus and Paul, we don't have anything from the first century. And matter of fact, Dan Wallace is the textual critic of Star of Christianity. He just texted me on his blog, and he said, I asked him front up, do you have the evidence for the first entry document for Mark? He says, Brett Strong, right now, I can't say anything. I'm under lock and key.
Yeah, okay, so but that's, right now, I understand. Okay, but let me, I'm not sure why that's relevant.
Just to show you that we don't have anything from the first century.
But why is that relevant? No, why is that relevant?
It's relevant because if you're going to say something is factual, then you got to back it.
No, Okay. Well, that's true. But what you're saying is the only kind of backing that is acceptable is something from the first century as opposed to copies that were second or third or fourth century. And you're saying those that if it's second or third or fourth century, then it's not reliably a copy of what was written in the first century. That's something that is open to actually verification based on the documentary evidence. What you are saying is, unless you can show me a document from the first century, I'm not going to believe that the words that the second or third century documents stated were actually said the way they were said. If that were the case, though, any document that was 100 years or 200 years removed from the original, any didn't matter how much evidence that you have in terms of documentary evidence, you would play the skeptic and say it's just a guess, even if the evidence didn't indicate that. So this is your choice to ignore the evidence simply because the documents don't go back as far as you'd like, not because the documentary evidence that we have now is not adequate to demonstrate that we can reconstruct the original. Even Bart Ehrman says that.
Okay.
And Bart Ehrman's one of the top in the world, and he's a critic of Christianity.
Okay. Back up for 1 second, real quick. When you say second century fragments we have of the New Testament, Frank Turk tried to pull that same one off the hat, and I was ready for him. Because I said Frank Turk.
Hold on just a minute. It doesn't matter. Second, third century.
Because me studying fragments, it's a guess. It's a guess that it was written in the second century because every single fragment in the entire second century, and I do believe the third century, but definitely the second century, it's all a guess. There's no dates. There's no signatures.
Let me guess.
So if
okay,
you're going
Brett,
to bring a
Brett,
fragment, you're still guessing.
Okay, Brett, let me tell you something here. Now, you have studied this enough to know that that these documents are dated by looking at the writing styles.
Exactly.
There are styles that are characteristic of particular times, and this is well documented. Consequently, when we have a writing style from a document that comes up, we can tell, based on the style, the period of time it came from. Now, if you're going to deny that, you're going to have to explain why, in this particular instance, it's more reasonable to believe that the style is a style that was not representing that time but was written at some other time. But just as a point of correction, Brett, and to be fair, it is not a guess. It is based on an academic assessment that is highly reliable. And just because you weren't there to see somebody put pen to parchment, it doesn't mean that we can't properly assess the date roughly of when that happened. But I just was just off the top of my head saying second century because that's not really the most important thing. Even if it's third or fourth century, we can still with the documentary acts, if we have enough documentary evidence, we can still make an academic decision and discernment about what the original have to say. There's lots of different ways to cross-check this information.
Yeah, but you do know second century, when we talk about second century fragments, so they have no dates and they still see them in the second century.
It's not
even you know that they give them. basically a 50-year back and forth. It's like the John Papyrus. They'll say, well, 125 A.D.
The John Ryland Papyri.
Or
right.
100. Yep. Even then, the experts of the world will say, well, we still have to give it a 50-year leeway either
so,
way.
So I don't know why.
They don't know.
Brett, they don't know within the 50 years. You're
that's
right.
A lot.
Stop. Wait, just a minute. They don't know within the 50 years what the specific date is because it does not have a date on it, like you said. That
so
doesn't mean,
then.
Brett, hold on. That doesn't mean that they can't, in a reliable method, determine what the range of the date is. The plus or minus bars are common in every single discipline, even in science. And so, but my point isn't that you have to have it. So you've got the John Ryland papyri, roughly 125, give or take 25. That's doggone early compared to the other documentary evidence. But it's not just that. It's second, it's third century and fourth century stuff too. And we have a massive amount of material to make the assessment. It's just not guessing. That's all, Brett.
Okay. Let me just say one word. And because you brought up Bart Ehrman.
You said one word?
And I'm a fan of Bart Ehrman. and this is what
I said that on this particular point that Bart Ehrman does not agree with you.
No.
And he's even
this
an enemy
Bart
of the guy.
Bart Ehrman says about, he was debating, I do believe it was Mike Lacona, but he said to the crowd, he goes, let me tell you something. Just because it's expert opinion, the expert said, it's just an opinion. It's expert opinion, but when we speak about the New Testament, ultimately it comes down to an opinion.
All right. That's
Dale
true.
Dale Martin from Yale University, the woozy professor,
Brett,
says,
I agree with you. Brett, I agree with you.
Okay,
but
so,
I only so think what, I'm going to take exception with one word, and that word is just. Just an opinion. Would you agree that some opinions are better informed than others?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, then that's the question, isn't it? It isn't a matter of just an opinion, the way you're trying to diminish it. The question is whether the opinion is well informed or not. I agree with Bart Ehrman. This is the fallacy of expert witness if you're not careful how you use it. Just because an expert says it, though, doesn't mean it's the expert. It's true, but it also doesn't mean it's the fallacy either. Some experts are in a position to know things that people like you and I are not in a position to know. So we have to be careful with labeling it a fallacy.
So you agree with me, though, that
I agree
it is
that
an assumption,
it's
ultimately, the words of Jesus and Paul of the first century?
No, I'm not agreeing.
Are you agreeing with me?
I'll tell you what I'm saying. Whether I agree with you or not is something you can decide for yourself. I am saying that all of these assessments in everything, even the thing that happened 20 seconds ago, is a matter of opinion. But that doesn't mean it's just an opinion, that it is guessing, that it's just a coin toss, and everybody's view is as good as anybody else's. What you have to do is you have to look at the evidence for the opinion itself to see which opinion is better than the other. That's the heart of the Rhodes Scholar tactic in the book on tactics.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I'm just saying, will you at least come out and say, yes, it is an opinion that these are the words of God, or, I mean, Jesus and Paul. I mean, will you at least say that? I mean,
I just said essentially that, but what
okay,
I
okay,
don't,
that's
wait,
fine.
Wait,
no,
Brett,
no,
wait, wait. I'm going to have the final word on this one because you're the one who's asking me for my opinion and on this, and because I think you're going to try to use my words and stick me with it later. So I'm just going to be really clear. I'm saying everything is an opinion. Everything is a belief. In fact, you can't have knowledge without belief, and you can't have belief without opinion. I am not saying everything is mere opinion and guessing, and that's the way you want to put it. And that's going to be my final word. And if you mischaracterize me, then your blood be on your own head, Brett, on this one. Okay, sorry, it's been fun talking to you, but I don't trust you on the way you're going to use this information, so I want to be really, really clear. Thank you for the call. Look forward to talking to you next time around. Let's see. Are we shy of break? Why don't I just... 353. Yeah, let's go to a quick break and I'll come back to Josh in Saskatchewan. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Babies have been aborted in the world since 1980. We have an obligation to defend the innocent and vulnerable, and you can learn how to defend the unborn and persuade others effectively and graciously. Stand to Reason's Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to enter any pro-life arena, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with full confidence that your case is solid and your appeal is just. From the comfort of your own home or church, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned plug-and-play course gives you everything you need to train yourself or a group in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through videotapes, workbooks, role-playing, quizzes, and games, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion through the use of graphic visual aids, to simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, to use scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, and to expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric. Please take a stand against abortion and learn how to engage others persuasively and graciously. Visit our online store at str.org to purchase the DVD curriculum Making Abortion Unthinkable, or call Stand to Reason at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON or our online store at str.org.
Final segment here at Stand to Reason. Just a quick comment about the last caller, and I actually didn't remember him. Apparently, Brett calls in the past, but I don't take note of those kinds of things. And it was a civil call, and I appreciate that. Although I was a little concerned when he characterized how Frank Turek answered him. I know Frank pretty well, and I've heard lots of presentations by Frank, and I was thinking to myself, Frank said that. He said that way. That was the best he could do. Now, so, you know, I just was wondering, was that actually a fair representation of what Frank had actually said? Now, I wasn't there. I don't know. But it just gave me pause. And then I started getting the same feeling at the end of the conversation, which is why I wanted to qualify myself very clearly and carefully, which I hope that I did. Of course, you never know what people are going to make out of the words that you say. But I'm going to trust Brett, whoever he was, for intellectual honesty and integrity here. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Let's go to Saskatchewan and, hello, Josh.
Hello there.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Saskatchewan's kind of the breadbasket, isn't it?
Yeah. Have you been here before?
I think I have. You're kind of right in the middle of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Regina's the capital, and then we're just west in Moose Jaw. So.
Okay. All right.
Yeah,
I'll let you do the pronunciation. All right. So I'll let you do the pronunciation. Some of those names are hard for me, but even Saskatchewan is a little bit of a stretch. But so what do we got today, Josh?
Well, first of all, I'm having a bit of a hard time hearing you.
I'm sorry.
Kind of low.
Okay. Is this better?
A little bit.
I'll try to snuggle up. Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
I can't get any closer, though. I'm right on top of the mic.
Okay, sure. Well, anyway, I've been dating this girl for a year and a half, and her parents, I just have a question about, like, honoring parents, but also kind of not putting up with certain behaviors,
mm-hmm.
because they're very manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
And what's even harder is that her dad's a pastor.
Mm.
And so, anyway, what happened last October was that she confided in her mom about some issues we were having, and then the mom decided that I wasn't the right guy for her daughter,
mm-hmm.
and so gave me a 3-month silent treatment and resorted to some other tactics, not Greg Kokel tactics,
mm-hmm.
but passive-aggressive behaviors mm-hmm. toward her daughter to try to get her to break up with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I suggested to her dad, well, why don't the four of us get together and talk? And his solution was rather he would prefer his daughter to send him nice stories about me, things that I did. Josh did this, Josh did that, in hoping that it would change his wife's opinion of me. So rather than talking, he'll just pass these nice anecdotes about me off to his wife. And I just was wondering, like, does that sound... It just that doesn't sound very Christian or biblical to me. It sounds...
Well, the way you've described it, no. It doesn't. I'm not saying that you're misdescribing. I'm just taking this at face value. And it does not sound very Christian. It does. It's not straightforward. It's not speaking the truth in love. It's subversive. It's deceptive. It's... you know, those kinds of things. It certainly doesn't lend itself to a integrity in relationship, regardless of whether you have a future with their daughter. One would like to think that Christians could be more straightforward in communication.
Right.
One would like to think that. But let me just say, at the same time, communication is not everyone's strong suit. And some people don't know how to communicate well. It's uncomfortable for them, and so they have these kind of end around adjustments that they make to compensate. And I'm not saying that this is a good thing almost universally. They create problems, but some people can't do much better. That's all I could say. It concerns me though, and I don't know what the particulars are that you guys are dealing with as a couple that she shared with her mom, but it may be that her assessment is sound. It may be that you're not a good match. I don't know. But going about it the way she's going about it, like giving you the cold treatment, the cold shoulder, and the whatever to her daughter, this is not the right way to communicate concerns. So, I guess I understand your frustration here. I'm not sure what else I can say that would help. I actually have one other thought, but what would you like to say in response to what I offered?
Well, it just surprises me with the behavior, because I guess you kind of expect more from Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And like right
well,
now,
I don't, but I mean, idealistically,
no.
You will, you know, but it's just, yeah, you would like to think that were the case. Certainly, we have grounds for better behavior and expectations, but it doesn't always happen, obviously.
Yeah, it's just, I think when I came along, the pattern kind of changed, because all of a sudden now we've started calling her parents out on some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And like, is that dishonoring your parents when you call them out on stuff they've done?
I don't think it's dishonoring to call them out. You have to be careful how you do it.
Yeah.
I think you can correct someone in an honorable way. By the way, the book of Proverbs has a lot about correcting, and it says some kind of correction, depending on the person, is not going to be very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, depending on the person, you correct a wise man and he will love you, is what Proverbs says. Correct a fool, and he will either scoff at you, or that's laugh, or he'll rail at you, get angry. That's generalization. I'm not trying to call anybody in this discussion a fool. I'm just saying Proverbs has something to say about these kind of interactions. And it is a noble thing, in principle, to be able to address problems with another person, if done properly. So it is not dishonoring for adult children to raise an issue with their parents and say that this is a difficulty, to put it on the table. We have to go with our hats in our hands. The younger men treat older men as fathers. And I think it says in Titus there, you know, so there's a way that we go about this, not in an uppity way with our nose in the air, but with an attitude of humility. Now, having said this, I just don't want anybody to get the misconception that I always do it the way I'm supposed to, because I don't. It's hard to do this. Okay, I understand that, especially when a lot is at stake and your emotions are high and all of that. But I still think it's the right thing to tell you. That's the basic. I don't think it's a matter of disrespect to address it, but you have to be mindful of how you do it. Now, having said that, I have something else I want to offer. If her parents are this way, I mean, there are two things, and I don't know what the depth of your relationship is and how close you are and what your plans of the future are, whatever. Mm-hmm. But family of origin have a profound impact on children. And when they grow up and get married, the family of origin doesn't go away. It's not only around them in-laws. It's not only around them physically as in-laws. It's around, it's in this woman. The children of the parents carry this with them. And so when people get married, the patterns of the family that they came from, if they're conflicting with each other, there's going to be conflict and adjustment has to be made. Now, there's always something like this because people come from different families unless you're a very close-knit community, which is a value of having marrying people much like you from communities much like yours. But if there are differences, then they're going to be those are going to show up in the marriage. So what I'm saying here is the difficulties you're having now, if you get married to this woman, are portentous for the future with your in-laws.
Right.
Yes. So this could be the way they relate to you for the rest of your life. They will probably warm up to you more, but their pattern of dealing with difficulties is showing itself here. And this is something you have to put it on the ledger and say, okay, this is liability. But it's not just a liability from the perspective of they'll be your in-laws. It can be a liability for the lady that you're going to marry. And not that she doesn't love you or whatever, but it is very difficult for a woman to go against the wishes of her parents. Even if she decides that it's a good thing to do, it takes an emotional burden. And it's an injury to her soul, and that's going to influence your relationship. So the segment's almost over here, but I just wanted to offer this as a bit of counsel to you that you be very careful and weigh all of these things in the balance, because this is a one-way ticket here that you're considering. It's a one-way ticket, and I know that you know that. I'm just reaffirming it. And so you want to marry wisely and marry well. And that includes not just the merits of the woman you have in mind, which I'm sure are significant, but also the package of the family, because it all goes together. And I thank you for your call, Josh. That's it, folks, for our show. Thank you for joining me. And sober note to end on, something for all of us to think about. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.